You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my terrific pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Ahmed Salah. He is the author of a new book called You Are Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution, a memoir written with Alex Mayassi. Ahmed Salah, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. I feel welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here and for having written this terrific book, which is full of lessons for anybody in Egypt or elsewhere going forward, wanting to change their society. I know you want to correct a bunch of misconceptions people have about the Egyptian Revolution and give us some lessons, but can we first look briefly at the background that the book recounts in such detail from around 2003 up to 2011? It was the U.S. attack on Iraq in 2003, in fact, that was the first spark that brought people out into the streets, was it not?
Yes and no. You see, with the invasion of Iraq on March 20th and 21st, we actually occupied Tahrir, and we had huge marches in all over Cairo, with involving hundreds of thousands of people and all that. And this was met with extreme brutality, as it is described in the book. Brutality that I have never seen before at that time.
Yeah.
And it was shocking to me, as it was shocking to everybody else. And it made us realize we cannot have this opium of thinking that we are protesting an aggression from an outside force if we are actually living under an oppressive local occupation inside. And we have to address this issue, our own freedom, before we think of wanting to liberate another nation being under attack, or any of that stuff that they were trying to put out, you know, in the media at that time, which is part of the hypocrisy of the regime of Hosni Mubarak at that time, who would pretend in the West as he is the best friend of the United States, and actually he does what the U.S. wants him to do, but at the same time, locally in Egypt, he would be portraying himself as the shield that protects Egyptians from the conspiracies of the Americans and Zionists. And therefore, he is trying to make himself the monopolist of any communication with us. At that time, like with Hosni Mubarak, and therefore, it was important to talk with international politicians, particularly here in the United States, which I described in the book in the years leading to the revolution.
You and others started organizations, Kafaya, meaning enough, and Youth for Change. And in fact, you recount in the book that when Bush's lies about weapons in Iraq fell apart and he started talking about democracy, that was actually to your benefit, and you found a little more freedom to demonstrate in the streets.
Absolutely. This was the story that we had in 2005, and actually starting from late 2004. And so we had some very strong movement in the street. But because the Bush administration at that time was not serious enough about actually supporting any democratic change in the region, for real, the U.S. just pulled out its pressure on the Egyptian regime to protect human rights, to respect human rights. And by 2006, that was a massive, you know, arrests, torture, thousands of people in prison, including myself. I was almost killed during this period. It was, I had long hunger strike. It was very difficult time for us. And then there was no opening of any political space in 2007, and even later. Like, we had to try to come up with ideas that were innovative in order to spread again the you know, the dissent, the awareness, the people having hope try to fight for their rights.
And one of the things you did with Youth for Change was you went to neighborhoods without announcing it on the internet or publicly and did quick demonstrations and street theater and then moved on before the police could get there. Is that right? And did that then...
Yeah, these are tactics that activists under very extreme conditions would have to do. They understand that their window for taking action is very limited. It could be limited to 10, 15 minutes in some areas. It could be limited to up to half an hour in others. But still, it's extremely limited. And in order to benefit from this, the best, of course, would be tactics that would be used in order to scout the area, in order to secure it, and to make something that would have an impact on the people, awakening impact, before pulling out very quickly and disappear. So we were bringing the message to people in their own neighborhoods in various places. And it was a very, to a certain extent, exciting even way of doing this for the activists who were involved. Once they learn how to do it right so that they are safe and they don't get arrested once they try to do something out there because they didn't know how to do it right.
And you recalled this practice years later, and it served as something of a model for your plan in 2011 to build up enough people to approach Tahrir Square. Is that right? How did that work in planning to get people in large numbers assembled?
Of course, trying to get into something like that is a gradual. Like you get bit pieces of experiences until you figure out how to do this thing or that thing, or then if that works, then you probably find a new way of getting the whole story, what was going on. Back then, it was, you look at it, the balance is extremely wrong. You have the nation's wealth in the hands of Hosni Mubarak, like 45% of the economy is in the hands of the military alone. And then the rest of the economy is in the hands of the goons of Hosni Mubarak, his friends. You have about 2 million individuals in his forces. So you have about 1.5 million in the police and another 500,000 in the military. Very strong security grip. So it feels for the people that there is no chance. And without trying to bring hope to the people, despite of the media constant brainwash, trying to undermine people, trying to make the different groups of the nation hate each other, to divide and conquer, the usual tactic. Despite all this, our work was to counteract all this and to bring hope to the people so they can rise. This was the challenge, and the book tells how to make it by showing many of the things, the tactics that didn't work, and finally what tactics seem to be more effective. So we can see the journey of how to find a solution that works in a country where the balance of power is extremely imbalanced between the people on one hand and those that have the authority, whether it's financial or military or political, on the other.
We're speaking with Ahmed Salah, whose book is You Are Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution. And it does indeed explain this experimentation over a period of years and different moments of possibility. You, in the book, state quite strongly that you think foreign journalists, in observing these activities, greatly overestimate and overestimated for years the role of the internet, the Facebook revolution, the Twitter revolution. Can you explain what they got wrong?
This was an attempt to a little oversimplify what was going on. But let's look at the facts and then try to understand what really was happening. So most Egyptians don't have access to internet in the first place. While the internet is constantly monitored because Egypt is a police state. And to try to organize using internet, we tried that several years. We have an event, you get a large number to sometimes of participants online. You go to the event, and it's always the same amount of a few dozen maximum of activists, surrounded by thousands of groups. Very thick security presence that would isolate us from our target. So we choose usually a large place where we would do this. And then we are disappearing in this large place because we are small in number, surrounded by a lot of troops, so people don't even know what's going on. They just see, you know, police presence. So that was not working for us. And in order to make this work, we had to have a plan. There was a plan that I had and I was hoping to materialize since 2008. And it has been mentioned in one of the WikiLeaks cables as I was trying to give some heads up about this at a meeting at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo in order to ensure that the U.S. will not go against our attack. And it was a real challenge to figure out how to work with these ideas because things were changing. Like the original plan was based on creating a movement, a new youth movement on new concepts with different structure than Youth for Change. So we started April 6th youth movement. And the structure had to reach, by the end of 2010, a certain form that there would be at an average of at least 50 semi-independent small groups of activists in the area of Greater Cairo, in addition to around 15 in every other government or like state here. And these are supposed to work in agitating, if you want to say, a neighborhood in the city where they are, in order to, by a certain time that was not specified yet back then, in April or in July 2011, it would be the day when we start a revolution. This was the initial plan. Of course, it had to go through changes as we had to go through the work and trying to come up with all these different solutions and so on. So it's explained in the book. It takes a long time to try to explain all this.
Yes, indeed.
I know our time is limited.
Well, I highly recommend that everyone read the book, but I think one of the more interesting points that, to me, that came up relatively late in the process was that you found that in the poor neighborhoods where you expected the most activism, you ran into people whose only source of news was the state media and who tended to believe it, whereas in middle-class neighborhoods, you found people with access to better information and more willingness to join an uprising. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have realized that there are two different issues that must exist together in order to bring about change. One is that, of course, there is something wrong that we need to change. And the other thing is our awareness that this is wrong and we need to change it. When people are subjected to constant brainwash, they lose the ability to actually stand for themselves because their reality is so fragile and is always threatened. And they just have to take what they hear and get on with their lives. And this is a huge problem. Therefore, we noticed in dictatorships that they would have a very strong interest in maintaining a kind of ignorant population, a population that is less informed, a population that is manipulated by propaganda through controlled media, et cetera, et cetera. And in a country, of course, like Egypt, where illiteracy is about half the population, unfortunately, and with extreme economical problems that had been worsening under Hosni Mubarak, and now they are a nightmare. Been a one-way slope, unfortunately, under the military going down. That's the situation. Like, what can you do? People, of course, would be not able to resist because they don't have this awareness. So we had to bring the awareness into places, and it seemed less working, the poorer probably the people were, for a little while. After the revolution started already, we had many people, of course, coming from every different category in Egypt, because that shook the country. And you would have the most educated university professors side by side with persons who are so poor that probably that nobody would employ them in their, you know, whatever business they have, because they are too rich and too snobbish originally. But I'm just trying to give an idea of, like, the different spectrum of people that participated in the revolution, the young and the old, the males and females, of course, Muslims and Christians, religious and atheists, all different groups of people unified in order to achieve the change that we aspire. Why did we have this kind of unity of all these different kinds of people? This is a very important question. And to ask this question and to try to look, for example, at the Occupy movement and how it went and so on, we need to pay some attention. A very important component of what we were doing was to take out the politics, take out what divides. We are all together in this. No one is a leader of another. We are all kind of shoulder to shoulder, you know, and fighting for the same thing with the same clear agenda, which is freedom, equality, justice, rule of law, transparency, democracy. Just the values that everybody agrees on, the universal values. And we are leaving anything political into after we succeed. This was the idea. Yeah. Unfortunately, the political process never succeeded, although the revolutionary process succeeded. Three times we brought three regimes. We brought Hosni Mubarak down, three decades dictator, then the military that followed him, and then the Islamist government that tried to make a copy of Iran in Egypt, which, of course, was not something Egyptians were happy about. And so we revolted again against this until we brought it down. But then the military are back in power in a clear coup d'etat, which is illegal according to the international laws, including that of the United States. So the United States should not have a relationship with this regime according to its laws. But the U.S. is arming Sisi, General Sisi, the dictator in Egypt, giving him a lot of political cover for his crimes against humanity. He had committed and is committing constantly crimes against humanity, which had been proven by reports of Amnesty International and different organizations, Human Rights Watch and so on, because of massacres, large massacres that were conducted under his orders a few times, in addition to the systematic disappearances of activists who get tortured till death. The fact that my colleagues in Egypt who are protesting almost every day, they get arrested for protesting and then they get sentenced at least 3 years of prison for protesting. I have other friends who are spending 15 years in prison now, sentenced for protesting, and people are still trying.
And the United States government, as you say, is arming that dictatorship like many other dictatorships around the world.
The Republican candidates particularly, it is so scary. They want to rely on regimes like, they want to make alliance like, you know, they would say, oh, what would I say to President Sisi? Or like, we have to depend on our allies. No, President Sisi. What are they trying to do?
You say Republican candidates in particular, while a woman named Hillary Clinton is running in the Democratic primary, whose family foundation took millions from any dictatorship it could get it from and waived all restrictions and shipped weapons everywhere.
To be totally honest, I know that we are, this is on air and everything. Actually, Hillary Clinton was very hostile to the idea of the Arab Spring and to the revolution. He was one of the most hostile to this. And
you met with her. In the book, you recount meeting with her, and she refused to offer any sort of assistance.
I did, and it wasn't that she refused. She wouldn't give any indication about anything, like not even an impression. Like, you're meeting with someone who's so cold, so just smiling and nodding and giving nothing of substance. When I had to work on the proposal the message I had from the Libyans, because I represented the Libyans with her at the very beginning, and with Assistant Secretary of State, Mike Posner, who I gave him exactly what the Libyans were requesting, which resulted a few hours later in the Security Council resolution that started the Libya process. I feel, of course, kind of, you know, this is not what we agreed about. Things went to hell, you know.
Yeah.
There were specific points that were clarified, and it was clear that actually the Security Council resolution came out at that time represented these ideas, but obviously what followed was there.
Before we run out of time, Ahmed, I wanted you to speak to this question that we had discussed earlier about nonviolence versus violence. Was this movement in Egypt was largely nonviolent, but there was violence within it, and you write in the book that you don't see a contradiction there. Was it violent? Was it nonviolent? How did it work?
We have been strongly nonviolent, but in a practical manner. What is the meaning of it? So we never use anything lethal to attack our opponents who are attacking us. We never use guns. We never use knives. Actually, in the perimeter, the entrances of Tahrir or any of the sit-in locations, you would have security entrances where there are volunteers that would give a body search and bag search to every single person coming in. Men for men, women for women, of course, and so on. The point is that we wanted to make sure we are never causing real harm to anyone. We looked at the other side as oppressed soldiers who are unaware and who are following their orders. So we resorted into different tactics. We would give these messages that are like, we are your brothers and sisters, we are your family, we are doing this for you, where will you be in the future, what will happen to your children. You know, like, there are always these things that you try to tell them so that you try to reduce the brainwash that they were exposed to. And on the other hand, when we get attacked, we have to defend ourselves. So we defend ourselves by breaking bricks into small pieces so that we are throwing stones, but not a stone that would break a skull or cause a real injury, just to keep them away Now, suppose there is an incursion and they're coming in with firearms and shooting, which happened several times. Then, in this case, we try to make a buffer zone with Molotov cocktails. So I am a very, very dedicated person to nonviolence. I was on a hunger strike when I was supposed to do my military service because I'm a pacifist until I actually died and broke back. I had a clinical death. But I was also teaching activists how to make proper Molotovs in order to defend our lives, in order to create the buffer zone so the soldiers on the other side wouldn't cross it, because who would want to cross fire? And so we can hide behind our barricades. This may sound like, this could hurt the soldiers and so on. This is not nonviolence anymore. But get to the real question here. We are being fired at with live ammunition. People get killed. Like in the massacre of Ahmed Mahmoud, the former minister of health at that time, in 2011, it was in November 2011, that we were under attack for 6 days in Tahrir. He said the number of bodies taken to hospitals at that time were 1,004. Most of the people who were killed were taken to their families. So we don't know the exact number, but I would suggest it would be probably 4 or 5 times. Because they used chemical weapons, they used firearms all the time, there were all these puncture wounds of bullets. There was TABON, which is nerve gas, there was BX, a nerve gas, there was TR, not just TS, which is considered a chemical weapon, and so on. It's been an issue that, of course, is discussed. And, so this is how we did nonviolence. It's a kind of a real practical nonviolence. So we are not saying that people should be so passive that they would get massacred. And we are not saying, you have to stand for your rights. You go and you say to cops, ACAB, you know, and all these things. No, this is so wrong. Neither is right. You defend yourself. You are friendly with the police. Those who were attacking us, when one of them gets injured, we were treating them. We will take care of them and until we send them back. So they're lying. Because then they go back there and they change the minds of their colleagues. So when they are ordered to fire, they don't shoot to kill. They shoot to miss. And this is very important. That saved lives.
Extremely important, and one of many, many important lessons in this book. We've been speaking with Ahmed Salah. The book is You Are Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution, a memoir.
And found on Amazon.
Yes. You can buy it online or at the bookstore or anywhere, and I highly recommend that you do. Ahmed, thank you for what you've done and for writing the book and coming on the program.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, opioids can be a lifesaver for some people with severe pain. But the overuse and abuse of powerful drugs like oxycodone is driving what the Centers for Disease Control says is an epidemic in this country, with some 16,000 overdose deaths from prescription opioids a year. But when the CDC pushed for non-binding guidelines encouraging doctors to seek alternatives where possible, the opioid industry, which made $9 billion last year, pushed back. Who's shaping the media story around what looks like a dispute between industry and regulators, in which the public interest and public health hang in the balance? Investigative journalist Lee Fong has been tracking the story. He'll join us to talk about what's going on behind the scenes. The role of industry in the opioid crisis on today's Counterspin. But first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. Listeners will know that on June 6th, the Associated Press unilaterally declared Hillary Clinton the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president, based on the news agency's own polling of unelected superdelegates. Superdelegates who have a role in the Democratic nominating process based on their institutional positions rather than being chosen by voters don't vote until the Democratic National Convention, July 25th. They can declare their intention to vote for one candidate or another just as voters can. And like voters, they can and do change their mind at any time. Media don't generally call elections weeks before the actual voting based on voters' intentions, and the timing of AP's announcement on the eve of primaries in California, New Jersey, New Mexico, Montana, and South Dakota, and caucuses in North Dakota raised concerns of voter suppression, intentional or not. The six states chose a total of 806 delegates, making it the second biggest day in the Democratic primary calendar after Super Tuesday. While other outlets, CNN, NBC, joined the rush to declare the nominating process over, but many people shared Fair's belief that there's just no good reason for a news outlet to preempt the Democratic process by telling people their votes don't matter. Even the Clinton campaign disapproved, so it's unclear what AP thinks they achieved, besides the ability to yell first. Then again, the wire service's own polls estimated that about 32% of California's eligible voters would participate in the primary. As of Wednesday afternoon, turnout was only 24%. They can likely take some credit for that. A Trump presidency could lead to a recession in 18 months, warned a June 6th Washington Post op-ed. The column's author said the risks to the U.S. and global economies of Trump's election are far greater than that of a British exit from the euro. And this opinion was the subject of news for outlets like CNN, Forbes, and Vox, who relayed the premonition as the dispassionate conclusions of a seasoned economist. Well, you can tell there's a hitch, and the hitch is the economist is Bill Clinton Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who, by many accounts, as Fair.org contributor Adam Johnson notes, was instrumental in creating the last recession, a bit of context left out of this recent round of attention. Summers blocked pre-crash regulation of Wall Street, testifying in a 1998 Senate hearing that derivatives regulation wasn't necessary because industry could be trusted to police itself. He was a key player in repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, which limited the involvement of commercial banks in securities trading. Overall, as The Atlantic's Michael Hirsch put it a few years ago, Summers helped midwife a major series of policy errors dating back 20 years that led directly to what many economists now believe was the worst financial crisis ever. And it isn't just a matter of considering the source. There's Summers' argument itself. He insists that two of the biggest dangers posed by Trump are his pulling out of free trade agreements and scaling back NATO. Well, there's dispute over what exactly caused the 2008 recession, but it wasn't fighting free trade pacts or scaling back NATO. It's certainly possible that Trump's economic ideas could bring on a disaster of some sort, but that smuggling in of pro-corporate and expansionist language tips us off to other motives. And finally, U.S. television live broadcast a Muslim prayer service June 9th. Of course, it was a memorial for world champion athlete and activist Muhammad Ali, who died June 3rd. And the fact that many Americans will likely see a janazah for the first time in association with a widely admired and beloved figure is some reflection of the intentionality of Ali's life. He planned, one guest told AP, for it to be a teaching moment. Coverage of Muhammad Ali's death can be a sort of teaching moment for media watchers as well, in the sense that it's good to remember that the version of a person that corporate media embrace and concretize in the public mind sometimes blurs that person's political complexity. So while media talked about Ali's conversion to Islam and his refusal to be inducted into the army because, as some even quoted, he refused, in his words, to go 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters of the darker people the world over. It's still hard, though, to convey how these things were heard, including by media, or what it meant to say them in 1967. Reading today, you might not know that, as sports writer Dave Zirin reminds us, Ali was deemed so dangerous his phone was bugged by the Johnson and Nixon administrations. That out on bail in 1968, he spoke at 200 college campuses. That peace activist Daniel Berrigan called him a major boost to an anti-war movement that was very white. That he would later describe his break with Malcolm X as his biggest mistake. Outlets like the New York Times didn't start using his name until years after he changed it, preferring dismissive locutions like Clay, who prefers to call himself Muhammad Ali. And here's sports journalist Jerry Eisenberg from the New Jersey Star-Ledger recounting the effect of his own 1967 defense of Muhammad Ali's draft refusal. Quote, "Some papers that carried my column regularly dropped it. Bomb threats emptied our office, making the staff stand out in the snow. My car windshield was smashed with a sledgehammer. Among the thousands of pieces of hate mail I received, two required the attention of postal inspectors. One turned out to be nothing but a ticking alarm clock, and the second contained what I hoped was dog feces." Close quote. Well, at the time, facing 5 years in prison, Ali himself addressed the media, saying, quote, "I strongly object to the fact that so many newspapers have given the American public and the world the impression that I have only two alternatives in this stand. Either I go to jail or go to the army. There is another alternative, and that alternative is justice." Close quote. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In 2014, the class of drugs known as opioids were involved in more than 28,000 deaths, or 61% of all drug overdose deaths, according to the Centers for Disease Control. The rate of opioid overdoses has tripled since the year 2000. Recent data show two different but related trends. An increase in so-called illicit opioid overdoses, largely due to heroin, and then this 15-year increase in overdose deaths involving prescription opioid pain relievers. Those drugs, like oxycodone and hydrocodone, or brand names like OxyContin and Vicodin, account for more than 16,000 fatal overdoses each year. The CDC says they're comfortable using the term epidemic to describe the crisis. Pharmaceutical companies say they lament the addiction and fatality problems tied to their products, but they also seem determined to resist efforts to address them, suggesting to do so would have to mean taking away relief from people in pain. It's a medical story, certainly, but it's also one that calls for following the money, and that's what our guest does. Li Fang is an investigative journalist whose work appears on The Intercept, among other places. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Li Fang.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk a little about how we got here to an opioid crisis. Anytime a powerful drug exists, there's an opportunity for abuse, of course, but this isn't just a tragic tale of unintended consequence. There are some factors, aren't there, in how these particular drugs were introduced.
Right. For some of the bigger, well-known opioids like OxyContin, manufactured by Purdue Pharma, these drugs were kind of rushed to market, there's evidence to suggest that early warning signs that showed how truly addictive OxyContin is were ignored in the approval process, and that the company did not really present evidence showing how dangerous and how likely patients were to overdose on OxyContin through the approval process. But the larger story of how we got to where we are today, where there's an epidemic that you referenced, not just from prescription opioids, but that the recent surge in heroin use and heroin overdoses is also linked to the prescription opioid industry. 4 out of 5 heroin users that started on opioid painkillers, many of those folks receiving those drugs just being prescribed by their doctors. And in America alone, about 81% of the global supply of oxycodone products and almost 100% of hydrocodone products such as Vicodin are used by Americans. So this is a uniquely American crisis. But to understand where we got to where we are today, it's really a marketing strategy that's been employed over the last 20, 25 years in which these pharmaceutical companies have pressured doctors, suppressed evidence, and they've coordinated a massive network of different foundations and medical societies to promote more use of these drugs for all kinds of different purposes, everything from minor tooth pain to minor back pain. There's clear evidence that the pharmaceutical companies were part and parcel to the recent surge we see in opioid use.
I want to just draw on one point that you just made. As you note, the Americans are 5% of the world's population, but we consume virtually all of the hydrocodone products like Vicodin and huge percentages of the oxycodone. And so you kind of have to ask, have other countries just not embraced the miracle? You know, they don't understand that this is a better mousetrap, you know, or maybe it comes down to marketing. And that brings us back to a company like Purdue Pharma that produced OxyContin for many years. And you talk about downplaying risks of addiction. I understand that they were sort of telling sales, I mean, not sort of, but telling their sales representatives to tell doctors that the risk of addiction was less than 1%. And it seems as though there was a gap between what they knew internally and what they were putting out to the public. And of course, that's what's so troubling to us, you know, is to know that a company can know something and yet regulators don't know it. And so, of course, the public doesn't know it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, this story is very similar to how, for example, tobacco companies use a vast political network and marketing strategy to push their product despite, you know, overwhelming science showing the health concerns of their product, or the oil industry using very sophisticated political strategies to suppress science. So for Purdue Pharma, they took a multi-pronged approach. In addition to kind of the typical pharmaceutical strategies, aggressively bringing on sales reps to push doctors to persuade them with different types of financial and other incentives to prescribe OxyContin and other opioids, and there was also kind of a more public-facing strategy where, you know, Purdue Pharma created a national network of different pain foundations. So these pain foundations would create marketing tools that would bring in people suffering from certain types of pain, from pain doctors, specialists, and pressure them to view opioids as the main type of recourse.
Right.
So between 1996 and 2002, Purdue Pharma funded more than 20,000 pain-related education programs, almost 10 a day, 7 days a week. During that time, Purdue conducted more than 40 national pain management training conferences in vacation spots like Boca Raton and Scottsdale, paying for more than 5,000 physicians to attend. And they also help create and fund specialty centers, like Academy for Pain Sciences, that would take doctors and give them all types of materials and prescribing guidelines to encourage the use of OxyContin and other opioids. And for certain areas of the country, they even created specialized regional pain foundations that would market the drug. So the Appalachian Pain Foundation, based in West Virginia, they were well-funded by Purdue Pharma and arranged meetings between doctors and local reporters. There's also evidence to suggest that Purdue Pharma and other pain companies would coordinate grassroots networks of pain patients. So when reporters would write stories saying there's this growing opioid epidemic, there are these problems with addiction, they would coordinate to send angry emails to reporters and claim that they were being stigmatized unfairly to push back against reporters and editors who are starting to peek around and look at this type of dynamic.
Right. And of course, the reason that that would have resonance is that there was a moment in which it was understood that pain was undertreated. And, you know, there are people who have severe pain and who want it to be taken seriously. And none of this is to undermine the situation that those people face, you know, but that's why that kind of narrative that claims to harness a grassroots voice or a voice of patients, particularly patients in pain, can be very persuasive. And yet you kind of get the story or another aspect of it from the fact that Purdue, for example, the makers of OxyContin, they're saying that they're patient advocates, but when patients get together, like some in Ohio did, to have a class action to say that they'd become addicted to OxyContin, well, then Purdue wants to block that.
Right. Like for any grassroots lobbying campaign, they seized on a legitimate grievance, and that's the undertreatment of some pain conditions, and they layered on some untrue claims, such as these guidelines and these marketing materials that claimed that opioids were not addictive or were not at high risk of addiction. And they organized individuals and these kind of very PR-savvy foundations to push this false claim.
Well, let's talk about what's going on now, because in response to what even media, you know, are calling attention to as an alarming crisis going on in terms of an explosion of abuse and of overdoses from opioids, the CDC said that they were going to put forward these non-binding guidelines to do with their prescription. And what happened then? The documents were leaked, essentially. And what happened?
Yeah, so last year, as the CDC took up guidelines that, as you mentioned, are voluntary, but kind of provide a government-endorsed idea of maybe best practices, as they were working on these guidelines to maybe discourage the high rates of opioid prescribing, a copy of the guidelines were leaked, and we really saw the kind of political machine of the opioid companies move into high gear. We saw a number of pharma-funded groups immediately attack the CDC. So there's evidence to suggest that members of Congress, working at some level in conjunction with pharma companies, threatened the CDC with an investigation, saying that this was unfair, that they were not having the right open process. Another group called the Washington Legal Foundation, which, you know, speaking of tobacco, they were very famous during the 90s in taking tobacco money and then filing lawsuits against places that were attempting to regulate tobacco, acting kind of as a neutral-sounding front. I mean, Washington Legal Foundation is kind of benign-sounding. Anyways, Washington Legal Foundation is funded by Purdue Pharma, makers of OxyContin, and they threatened the CDC with legal action over the guidelines. And according to the Associated Press, a group called the Pain Care Forum, another one of these pharma-funded fronts for the opioid industry, organized regular meetings in Washington among lobbyists and other painkiller advocacy groups to start pressuring policymakers, pressuring the people at the CDC to, if not back away from these guidelines, to water them down. So we know from a lawsuit filed by the city of Chicago that the top lobbyist for Purdue Pharma actually controls the Pain Care Forum. And the company, of course, also funds Pain Care Forum. So, you know, it's the same kind of constellation of groups that have existed for a very long time, now kind of kicking into political gear, attacking the CDC. And after the CDC released a preliminary version of these guidelines, I believe last December, they received even more criticism, both from Capitol Hill, from some allies of the pharmaceutical industry, and from these political groups and these foundations of financed and controlled by pharmaceutical companies. And after an open comment period, finally, the CDC handed down its guidelines in March of this year. And the guidelines basically say for most types of routine pain-related health issues, doctors should not prescribe high dosages of opioids as the first choice. I mean, anything from ibuprofen to other kind of pain care management therapies should be tried first. And then, you know, if those don't work out, the high dosage opioids might be acceptable. And again, these are voluntary guidelines.
Well, and after the guidelines came out, has there not been pushback since that we're now going to, am I misunderstanding, that we're not going to revisit it and go back and bring more, quote unquote, stakeholders to the table? I thought that that sort of reopening had been achieved in a way by the industry side.
Yeah, and that's a kind of interesting dynamic here. So we did a story recently, again, on the guidelines. And, you know, as going to midterm elections, we've just kind of, by circumstance of the Senate election map, we have a lot of senators from the Northeast, which is a region that's been heavily hit by the opioid and heroin epidemic, up for re-election this year. So these legislators from places like New Hampshire and Pennsylvania and Ohio are adamant about taking something to voters, saying that they've dealt with the opioid crisis, they've been leaders in passing big legislation, fixing the problem. And the administration, the Obama administration, is also eager to say that they've done something big. And the big package coming out of Capitol Hill in just the last few weeks that supposedly addresses the opioid crisis mostly provides some money and incentives for drug treatment of addiction and for increasing the supply for first responders with Narcan, which is an overdose drug that helps revive someone who's an overdose right. on an opioid. And these are positive developments, but, you know, as we pointed out in our piece recently, the legislation does nothing to crack down on pharmaceutical companies to try to limit the overprescribing of opioids, and in fact might actually be a step backwards, because there is a provision in the bill that sets a new task force, which will have industry and other stakeholders in the process to review the CDC guidelines. So there's a potential in the future that the industry might have a second shot at going after these CDC guidelines that they've been so concerned about.
It's very interesting that the response is to put more of industry representation on the decision-making body. I mean, if I could just pull out to a bigger picture view, it sounds as though what we're saying is, you know, you can't have a government panel on climate change without the oil industry, because that's their thing. You know, I mean, there's something funny about this philosophy that says that you can't have a panel about change. It's not legitimate unless it's like 50% ardent invested advocates for the status quo, you know, as though you're not legitimate to be in the room discussing something unless you make money off it. You know, it seems a very kind of strange attitude for government regulators to take up, frankly.
Yeah, and we've seen this strategy employed recently on a whole number of issues, you know, where there's a lot of public support. You know, the public is demanding some type of government response to the opioid crisis. And, you know, if you look at how lobbyists are attacking other kind of popular issues, you know, payday lending is another one. You know, Republicans on Capitol Hill have given up on trying to repeal the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Their claim now, their kind of strategy over the last few years has been to instead say, you know, these regulations, they need to be formulated with the input of industry. They've been trying to add new commissioners and advisors to the board that are representatives from the payday lending industry and from other financial firms and Wall Street, hoping that by having more of a stake in the process of creating these rules, they can weaken them or make them effectively useless in a procedural way. So, you know, this is a similar strategy that we're seeing here, that, you know, it would be, now it seems too difficult to repeal the CDC guidelines, the previous efforts by these front groups to derail them through lawsuits or the threat of lawsuits. That was a failure. So the next kind of phase is, okay, we can't get rid of the CDC guidelines. How do we create this new body that will oversee them, that will have representatives from industry?
Well, let me ask you, finally, it's not really a pivot because it's the same issue. If the industry backing didn't raise questions about the sincerity of the claims of some of these groups and pain foundations and some of the individuals involved here, their claims that they're really only concerned with people in pain and providing them access to pain relief, well, the role that some of these same folks are playing in the marijuana legalization story would seem to raise questions about that for driving interest in pain relief. There is some connection between these two stories, isn't there?
Yeah, that's kind of the I think the next wave of reporting and a big policy fight going into the future is we're seeing a number of studies now suggest that marijuana can be an effective treatment for some pain management, and in some cases even more effective than powerful prescription opioids. And so we've seen Elizabeth Warren and other legislators try to convince government agencies like Medicare and the Veterans Administration to at least allow some patients to seek medical marijuana, and that there should be more studies on this approach. But interestingly enough, as the opioid industry has attempted to gain influence or buy off the anti-drug and pain-related foundation world, some of the largest anti-drug advocacy groups in America, like the group called CADCA, Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, and one of their largest donors is actually Purdue Pharma. And they notably, even though opioid drug abuse is one of the biggest problems faced in the drug abuse community, mostly sat on the sidelines when it came to the CDC guidelines fight. They kept their mouth closed and did not encourage people to go in and promote the guidelines, which really contrasts with their approach to marijuana, where they've held rallies and organized grassroots lobbying drives to keep marijuana prohibition and to continue the criminalization of marijuana.
Well, it seems like there's just no substitute for following the money. I'd like to thank you very much for connecting those dots for us, Lee Fong. We've been speaking with Lee Fong. You can find his work on this and other issues online at TheIntercept.com.
Thank you so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. And the website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. I'm Alex with four interviews for you in this packed show. Ranging from the most terrible climate news to the most hopeful, here we go. Is the Great Barrier Reef on death row? That's the question asked and answered years ago at the prestigious Royal Society by John Varon, except the world knows him better as Charlie. He's also been called the Godfather of Coral because about one in five corals were named by him. He was the chief scientist at the Australian Institute of Marine Science and author of the authoritative three-volume set, Corals of the World. Charlie Varon, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Where did the nickname Charlie come from?
From when I was 6 years old, my school teacher used to call me Mr. Darwin, until one day I brought something nasty into the classroom to scare all the kids, and she said, Charles Darwin, get that out of here. And the name Charlie stuck. I've been called that all my life. I don't answer to anything else.
So you've just returned from yet another sea voyage. What were you up to?
Back up to the northern Great Barrier Reef, basically to see what's been happening to the corals there since I was up there about a month ago.
And how's it going?
Well, it was a very horrible trip. In fact, it was heartbreaking. I went to Lizard Island, which is up in the north and has a big marine station there. And virtually all the coral that had been bleached now looks healthier because it's all covered with slime, slimy filaments, cyanobacteria. And all the corals that we thought would probably pull through haven't. They've bleached as well. So it was a very horrible trip. Terrible, in fact.
This is something that's hard for us to understand as beginners. Why do coral animals suddenly expel the algae that they depend on?
Well, corals live in a very competitive environment where land and sea and air all interface, and it is very competitive. So they get the algae in their tissues that give the biggest bang for the buck. But that means getting the algae that are as close as possible to the maximum temperature they're exposed to. Well, for the last million years or so, that's been fine. But we're now exceeding the maximum temperature that they've been selected for. So the algae are getting toxic. They release too much oxygen, and that oxygen actually kills the coral cells, as it will any animal if you get too much. And so the coral expels the algae, forgetting that they absolutely depend on the algae for their food supply, and they die. And so what happens first, you see the algae being expelled, and the coral turns white because the color comes from the algae. And then the little polyps get smaller and smaller, they shrink, and within about a month or so, they die. So that's happening right across the Indo-Pacific now. It's the worst year we've ever had.
Can they come back once they bleach?
No, the coral dies. If there's their colony, so if some of the polyps still hang on, they can regrow at least part of the colony. But mostly the whole colony dies, and it's only new seeding of new larvae can the reef regenerate. But coral bleaching typically doesn't wipe out all the corals on a reef. But this time, that is the normal story. At least they're wiping out a big part of most of the reefs of the Northern Great Barrier Reef. It's pretty horrible to see, I can tell you.
It's touching. So do we have a direct and proven link between climate change and this disaster you're telling us about now for coral?
Well, you can never specifically point to cause and effect, but we know it is definitely linked to carbon dioxide levels. There's no conceivable doubt of that. And if you look at the plot of graphs of plot carbon dioxide levels over time, you see then they're normally between 280, 320 parts per million. We've now hit 400 parts per million, and the spike is just climbing vertically on almost any scale. So it's blindingly obviously due to humans putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. There is no other explanation.
So is there some upper limit in carbon emissions where we can just say we won't have any coral?
Yeah, we're at that now.
Oh.
What happens is that the oceans, they respond slowly. It's like putting a kettle on the stove. the kettle's cold when you put it on and takes a while to warm up. So if you think of the oceans as being a very big kettle, we've put this blanket of carbon dioxide, which is warming the oceans, we've put it there. And it'll take about another 20 years for the ocean temperature to equilibrate to the blanket of warming we've got now. And so if we stopped adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, kept it around what it is now, it would take about 20 years for the oceans to equilibrate with that. So the outlook is horrific.
And I've heard snippets about coral dying in the Indian Ocean as well. Is this a worldwide event where the coral is under threat?
Yes, it's right across the Indian Ocean, and it's been right across the Pacific. We don't know the extent of it in great detail because there's only a fairly narrow window of time that you can actually see the bleaching. If you flew over the northern Great Barrier Reef now, you wouldn't see much bleaching at all because filamentous algae grow on the dead coral and they take over in a matter of weeks. So as most of the coral reefs of the Indo-Pacific are fairly remote from humans, we don't really ever capture a good idea of how extensive bleaching's been. But NOAA's temperature forecast was horrific, and they've been correct. So we expected a lot of damage, but fortunately, the worst was averted because the local weather in this part of the world did reverse somewhat. We had a big cyclone off Fiji, and so a normal monsoon set in before the ENSO cycle could do its worst, the natural cycle of warmth that is an atmospheric thing. So the central and southern Great Barrier Reef mostly have not had severe bleaching. All the corals would have been sick, but bleaching occurs right down through the range of corals right around Australia and out into the Indian Ocean. And as you probably know, the coral in the Hawaiian chain has been really badly damaged, and there's been endless reports of bleaching elsewhere in the Pacific. So it's a pretty it's been a very bad year.
Are there deep cold water coral as well?
There's reef corals that do live in quite cold water. In this case, down as far as Sydney, there's a few species and so on. That's bleaching too. So corals do respond to what's normal in their local environment. But there's a whole other group of corals that don't resemble reef corals much, that live in very deep water, and they don't have algae in their tissues, so they don't bleach. But even reef corals are quite happy tolerating the temperature we have. But when you combine that with sunlight, that's the combination that causes them to die.
So as you've told us, coral has been around for perhaps 500 million years. It's come through several mass extinction events. It's still here. Why are you concerned this time around, Charlie Varon?
Well, the coral of the Paleozoic was entirely wiped out by the end of the Paleozoic, the great mass extinction then, and nothing survived. And the coral we have now is another group of organisms, the soft-bodied organisms, evolved. So that happens when corals can be completely wiped out. But that's never happened any other time. We've had over 30 occasions in the geological record where reefs have been wiped out as far as their geological record shows, and they haven't come back for a long period of time, you know, hundreds of thousands of years perhaps. But of the mass extinctions, all but one of those are fairly obviously associated with ocean acidification. It's because it's really hard to find anything that could affect the oceans as much as that worldwide. So we're looking at two things. We're looking at the bleaching, which will have affected corals everywhere in geological time, and also ocean acidification. Now, corals can't evolve mechanisms to cope with acidification much, but they can evolve a capacity to have different algae in their tissues, which is tolerant of temperature. But this is evolutionary time. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years. We're not giving corals the time to adapt to what's been thrown at them now. And as you no doubt know, the rate of increase in carbon dioxide is not abating at all. It's just keeping on, keeping on. So it's a very doom and gloom outlook. It's very serious.
Well, from the human perspective, I mean, setting aside the beauty and the right of coral to exist in its own right, As an Australian, what does it mean if the Great Barrier Reef suffers a major decline? What are the impacts for fisheries or for the human economy?
Well, for the Great Barrier Reef, they're massive. The Great Barrier Reef is worth about $7 billion a year to Australia and employs 70-odd thousand people. So there's that aspect of it. But the real harm is not a human one. Corals are home for about a third of all marine species somewhere in the life cycle, and that includes a heck of a lot of fish. So if you take out corals, you also will take out a big swag of the diversity of the oceans. And that's what we have seen in the fossil record. First of all, coral reefs go, and then the diversity of the ocean plummets, and the oceans are really the lungs of the earth. The atmospheric conditions are moderated by the oceans all the time. And when you take life out of the oceans on that scale, the oceans cease to have the same function a healthy planet has. And that's when that gets really severe, that's when a mass extinction kicks in, and that takes out terrestrial life as well.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with one of the world's great coral experts, John or Charlie Varon. Unfortunately, we are talking about coral on death row as the world heats up. Charlie, I've got to ask you, what got you going on coral in the first place?
I was doing my PhD on neurosecretions, of all things. I've never been to a lecture in marine biology in my life. And decided to take up diving for fun. And we found lots of corals off the coast of New South Wales, not far north of Sydney. And no coral had ever been recorded there, but there's some islands. And we went out there for fun diving. And it was a fabulous spot covered with corals. And I decided that we would go ahead and do our best to make this into a marine park. In fact, only last week I was down there celebrating the 25th anniversary of the marine park. It wasn't my doing. Our study was long lost and forgotten. But then it was picked up by another group. And that's the start of the marine park there. But my diving goes back to those days when I was doing fun dives. But I soon turned that into, firstly, my hobby, and then, as I keep on doing, turning my hobby into my job. And so I became the first scientist to be employed by the Australian Institute of Marine Science. And I have been on 66 expeditions, 6,000 hours of diving all over the world, redoing the taxonomy of corals, the distribution, and then into their evolution and all sorts of other things. But it started as a hobby and certainly became one of my foremost loves in life. It's very easy to get very closely attached to coral reefs. And it never wears off. I get thrilled just as much today as I ever did diving on a really beautiful coral reef, and I'm afraid it's been a good while since I've had that pleasure. They're all going backwards.
I can hardly imagine the pain you must be feeling to see them suffering and threatened with extinction.
Well, it's horrible. I mean, it's just terrible. If you're a music lover and you see one orchestra after another collapse for whatever reason, and you get less and less music, and that music you do get is really second-rate stuff, and you've seen the very best there is, your life becomes almost intolerably diminished. And I find myself in that predicament. It's very hard to cope with. Yep.
I think we're all entering that predicament as we see the climate we've come to know disappear and some great troubles coming. So look, Charlie, what do you recommend to listeners who want an introduction to coral and how it works? Is there a film, a website, or a book we should all get in touch with?
Well, there are many and there are none. I wrote a book called A Reef in Time, The Great Barrier Reef from Beginning to End. It's published by Harvard. It was in 2008, and that gives the science behind what we've just been talking about. Yeah, that book was the book that precipitated an emergency meeting of the Royal Society in London, which was chaired by David Attenborough, who's highly regarded in this corner of the world. Of books about the Great Barrier Reef, I think there's about 700, but of coral reefs, a very large number. Mostly the books that I've written concentrate on coral, that being my speciality. But from there, there's speciality books about fish and whales and a lot of other marine life. And also a lot of fabulous books depicting the beauty of coral reefs. So it is something that everybody really needs to see because it really is the showcase of nature on this planet.
It's been designated a World Heritage Site by the United Nations, but I wonder how much duty falls to Australia to protect it, and how is Australia doing when it comes to trying to save this reef?
Well, Australia is doing the worst thing it possibly can, and that is giving okay for massive amounts of coal mining. It only just last month gave the go-ahead for a mine that will put 3.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Australia it's got an abominable track record. It's politicising this by spending money on the Great Barrier Reef on things they actually don't need doing. But basically, when you spend a whole lot of money looking after the water quality or trying to control the starfish that eat coral, that is money wasted if you're going to have a reef that's going to die anyhow. So every country, not just Australia, but every country has got to do its absolute utmost to get on to renewable energy and get unhooked from fossil fuels. Unfortunately, that's not a vote winner in Australia. Well, it might be. We just hope it will become that. But our political parties, both of them, have okayed this coal mining, although one party, the left-wing party, is doing some things towards climate change mitigation. We've had this meeting in Paris, as you'll know, that was very successful because it got a whole lot of countries to actually sign on to the existence of climate change, which is so late in coming, it's heartbreaking, but this could have happened 25 years ago. Science was there 25 years ago. Anyhow, a lot of countries, most countries in the world have signed on to that, but I'm afraid the premise is a false one. Their aim is to keep the world's increase in temperature below 2 degrees, and that's not possible. So we are in for a horrific time, and the only way of getting through this is to have countries committed doing big things towards stopping climate change.
And so most of my listeners do feel this threat to coral right in their hearts, I think. What can we do?
The main thing you can do is vote for politicians who are going to control, who say they're going to control fossil fuel mining and are going to support getting on to green energy. That's the strongest thing. But then there's the individual's lifestyle. And as you know, we're getting very fuel-efficient cars. And that makes a hell of a difference. And, of course, we've got appliances in most houses, which are now becoming very efficient. And we've got to give technology the space, the time to develop and kick in. Unfortunately, if you go mining coal, that will always undercut the cost of the technology. And so the longer countries keep mining coal, and there's an awful lot of it yet to come, that will put the brakes on alternative technology for developing renewable resources. So Australia's doing really badly at that, I'm afraid.
So, Charlie, maybe we shouldn't leave this as a funeral. Would you tell us one or two stories about the strangeness of coral or the wonders that you've found?
Yes, I hate leaving this as a funeral. I hate being the doom and gloom merchant because most of my life, coral reefs have been fabulous places and I would never have even dreamt that this would ever change in this way. But to dive down on a healthy coral reef is really a fabulous experience. And I think one of the greatest times I've had in my life is diving at night and turning the torch off and just enjoying the moonlight. And the whole reef is just crawling with life. See life absolutely everywhere. And you can turn the torch on and it all changes colour, suddenly leaps at you. There's nothing remotely like this. I think probably the nearest thing would be some spectacular rainforest garden or something like that. But coral reefs also had the intangible thrill of being, well, dangerous. You never know about some of the life that swims past you. But the overwhelming thrill of diving on beautiful reefs is just the diversity and just the amount, the quantity of living things that the reef supports. There's nothing like it anywhere on this planet, not even a rainforest. That is the great thrill of diving on a beautiful coral reef.
To me, it's like visiting the heartbeat of nature.
It definitely is that. There's nothing in the oceans that have anything like the diversity of coral reefs, not 1% of it. So for the oceans, that's it, coral reefs or somewhere else that's nothing remotely comparable. But for the whole world, I guess going into an Amazon-type rainforest and seeing the diversity of life there and the excitement and the thrills and that, all that, that's the next best thing. I think the greatest thrill you can ever have I love immersing myself in nature. I always have since I was a child, whether it be a forest or a reef. And to immerse yourself in a reef, just to take the time to just look around and really feel it, is one of the great privileges of living on this planet, I'll put it that way. It certainly is for me, and it is for an awful lot of people. Everyone should go see a coral reef because it will stay in their memory forever until they die. It is one of the most thrilling things, I think, you can do on Earth today as far as looking at nature is concerned. That's how I can put it, but there's nothing like it.
Well, John Viren, is better known as Charlie, has won numerous awards. His book, A Reef in Time, The Great Barrier Reef, From Beginning to End, is still the classic to read, in my opinion. And you can check my show blog at ecoshock.info for a link to that video of Charlie presenting to the Royal Society, introduced by David Attenborough. Charlie, thank you so much for sharing your time and for being such a good friend to coral during your lifetime.
Thanks, Alex, and what a nice interview that was. Appreciate it.
Radio EcoShock.
Top scientists warn humans must start removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or we could encounter a climate catastrophe. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assumes we will use so-called carbon capture and storage. But where is the technology to do it? Nothing reliable has appeared until now. A project in Iceland has discovered a way to convert carbon dioxide into stone in less than 2 years. That's fantastic news. It's a game changer, but it has limitations. Let's discover what this new tech called CarbFix is all about. Our guest is a co-author of a new paper published in the journal Science on June 10, 2016. The title is Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. Dr. Martin Stute was educated at Heidelberg University. He is now professor of environmental science at Barnard College, Columbia University in New York, and a hydrologist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Martin Stute, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's exciting news. We're not talking about a theory or a model, but a carbon storage process that has already worked. Have you held a piece of this new carbon stone in your hand? What is it like?
Yes, I have. Actually, the first time we saw it was in a monitoring well. So we are injecting the CO2 with water at one place, and it flows through the subsurface. And then the reactions happen. And then we have a monitoring well, another hole in the ground where we have pumps, and we pump up water to the surface and monitor the composition of this water to find out what's happening. And what happened is that the pump failed. So that was the first time we saw it. We pulled out the pump, and the inside of the pump and on the outside of the pump and on the pipes, there was a white material that looks like if you pour sugar on a surface, so small crystals. And then, of course, we analyzed these crystals right away, and we noticed that these crystals are carbonate minerals, you know, same material that seashells are made of. And then we knew that these minerals are forming in the system, so we are converting CO2 into minerals.
And where is this all taking place?
So this is taking place maybe 30 kilometers east of Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, and it's very close to a geothermal power plant. And we are using gases that are released currently from this power plant to the air, and we pipe that to a site a few kilometers away, and then we inject it close by into a basalt formation. Now, you would think that maybe geothermal power plants should not emit anything. You know, they are very green, renewable energy, and so on. But the reason why they emit CO2 is that the very hot water that they convert into steam that then drives the turbine also contains CO2 from very deep in the earth. This is a volcanic area, and there is CO2, and the CO2 is in the water, in the steam, and currently gets released into the atmosphere. So the Icelanders wanted to not emit the CO2 to help prevent climate change, and they decided to invest into a technology to get rid of it.
And could you describe for us sort of a brief step-by-step of capturing and storing carbon dioxide at this plant?
So the capture process is actually fairly easy in this situation because the gases come out of the turbine and we can actually use the gases almost as they are. There's a little bit of treatment of the gas, so there's some hydrogen in there that we reduce the concentration of in a very fast process in the power plant. And then the remaining gases, which is mostly CO2 and hydrogen sulfide in this particular case, this rotten egg smell. So these two gases then go through a pipeline and they go to a well a few kilometers away. They are pumped down through a pipeline, through a tube into the well. And then at the same time, we are pumping water through another pipe also into the well. And then at depth, like in an aquarium, we have a sparger or, you know, bubble stone that you would buy for an aquarium. Of course, it's much bigger in this case. The CO2 bubbles out of one pipe and then mixes with the water that we pumped at the same time. So by the time that this mixture enters the formation, you know, the basalt formation, the CO2 is completely dissolved in the water. There are no bubbles left, which prevents any CO2 from leaking upward, which can be a problem at conventional CO2 sequestration or CO2 storage sites, because as long as CO2 is in gas phase, it can move upwards, of course, like bubbles would in a glass of seltzer water. The chances that they would reach the surface at these other sites are extremely small, but it's not zero. So in our case, we dissolve the CO2 right away in the water, and then there's no incentive for the CO2 to move upwards anymore. And then, of course, in the second step, the CO2 reacts with the basaltic rock and forms these carbonates that then stay behind as initially small crystals, which will grow over time in the rock.
That's pretty clear. Now, the key to it is this rock called basalt. What is that?
So it's a volcanic rock. You know, consider it, it's basically lava flows in Iceland. You know, there are lots of volcanoes in Iceland. There were recent eruptions, as you know. Over the years, thousands of years, there were many eruptions, so there are lots of layers of this lava, and the formation of this kind of rock is called basalt. And it is very fresh, and it has this property that it reacts with CO2 also under natural conditions, so it forms carbonates. But we all thought that this would be a very slow process, and perhaps we couldn't use this to actually engineer it to deposit CO2. But this experiment showed that actually this can work on a very short time scale, very fast, much faster than we all anticipated.
And Martin, as we learned from your paper in Science, another required component is lots of water. Previously, water wasn't considered important in carbon capture and storage. How much water is required, and could seawater be used?
I think we don't really know the answer yet. No field experiment has been done, but it's likely it will work. There are some hints that it will work. But of course, one has to really try it, as we did in Iceland in the real world, and perhaps inject CO2 dissolved in seawater into a basalt, which could be an ocean floor basalt. I mean, that's the ocean floors is the place on the Earth where the basalt is very common. 90% of the ocean floor or more is basalt. So if we could figure out how to do this on the ocean floor, that would really be fantastic, you know, because we had an unlimited reservoir of basalt. If we just would have to get the CO2 to the oceans, and that would be a problem potentially, you know, if it's far away. But there are many coastal areas that have basalt just offshore, and there are many power plants near the coastlines because power plants want to be where people are, and people like to be near coastlines. But I think it's a little bit too early to tell if this works or not, because it has to be really tried in a pilot experiment similar to the one in Iceland.
Yeah, when I was looking into this, I noticed previous research into storing carbon dioxide under the sea in basalt. For example, there's a 2008 paper, Carbon Dioxide Sequestration in Deep Sea Basalt by Goldberg et al.
Right.
But now you've added some new twists to this, especially the injection of water. And so this is a little bit different from what they had envisioned, is it?
I mean, what they are envisioning is it's all theory, right, at this point in time. So it's an idea that would have to be tested. I think they were considering not only CO2 dissolved in water injections, but they were thinking also of injection of CO2, pure CO2. But because there's water in these formations anyway, the reactions might work in a similar way. I guess we need to find out. We don't know for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And some other countries who could use it. Could America do it?
Yeah, I mean, there are the biggest basalt occurrence in the United States is the Columbia River basalt in Washington State. So that would be a potential location. There are basalts offshore of New York City, actually, off the west coast of the United States. And then within the country, there are several spots as well. So about 10% of the continental rocks are basalts.
And how about India, for example?
India is another big basalt occurrence. So that has also been proposed in previous papers to study that place.
And you moved the CO2 in a pipeline. Could we picture some way of transporting the CO2 from power plants that aren't near basalt to remote locations and then store it the way CarbFix is doing?
Yeah, we could envision that. It just will add significantly to the cost of the technology.
And can bacteria get into this carbon-loaded rock and destabilize it?
There's no evidence for that yet. So there are groups that are studying this. So certainly the role of life in this process is probably underappreciated and has not been studied as much because it's very complicated. There are so many different kinds of microbes that live down there. But there is a group associated with the CarbFix program that does just that. And they are studying the role of microbes in these systems. So they may be important. We don't know for sure yet.
And the other big news, which you've mentioned in this CarbFix story, is how quickly that CO2 morphed into a stable stone. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, what the previous expectations were and what happened?
Yeah, so the previous expectations were that this would take a very long period of time, hundreds of years, maybe longer than that. Then people started to do laboratory experiments, and they actually found out that it's significantly faster than that. And then there was a modeling study a few years ago that took the composition of this local basalt and, you know, a lot of information that had been gathered in laboratory experiments for many years, and they predicted that it would take about 10 years. But the scientific community just didn't believe that paper. It was actually a little difficult to publish because they just didn't believe that this could happen that fast. And then it actually happened in 2 years, so much faster even than that. Why that is, we speculate in the paper. We have some ideas why it could be. We may underestimate, for example, the surface area of the rocks. Part of that might have been a dissolution of existing carbonates through our injections that then were deposited someplace else. So there are several theories why what happened, but we actually have a difficult time at the moment to differentiate between them. So we need further studies to figure this out.
And of course, the worry, Martin, with any good news about carbon capture and storage is that the public will run away with it. People may think it's okay to pollute now because scientists have a permanent solution. Do you worry about that?
I do, yes. And I want to be clear and say this is not a silver bullet. I think we have to invest in lots of different approaches, you know, switching to renewable energy. We need to be more efficient. We need to look at other carbon sequestration techniques, and this could play a major role in this whole discussion, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not solving our problems. You know, it's rather, I think we have to push these other technologies as fast as we can, but we feel like we cannot really displace fossil fuel energy sources very rapidly. We should do it as fast as we can, but it's not going to happen overnight. And while in this transition period, this technology could be very relevant. And also, I wanted to mention one other thing. You know, we may even underestimate the damaging effects of climate change. Who knows? You know, people usually claim that it doesn't exist and we are overestimating it. But the other thing could happen too. Maybe we underestimate it. And maybe we have to, at some point in the future, remove CO2 from the atmosphere just to reduce the levels, so capture CO2 from the air. And then this technology could be very relevant. You know, if it works in the oceans, we could actually capture CO2 out of the atmosphere on old drilling platforms maybe and inject the CO2 into nearby basalt formations. And then we could lower the CO2 levels. I don't know if we will have to get there. But if we do, you know, we better be ready to do this and figure and make sure it works.
Yes, because scientists like James Hansen say we need to go back down to at least 350 parts per million of CO2 in order to maintain any sort of ice at the poles, and we need that in order to have our climate system, and on we go. Look, as an aside, can you tell us about your other research into ways to figure out the ancient past by analyzing current groundwater?
Oh, you're aware of that. So groundwater moves very slowly in the subsurface. So if you go a few hundred meters below ground and you are in an area, what we call a sedimentary basin, basically a bathtub filled with sediments, then since groundwater moves very slowly, you know, maybe a meter per year or something like that, if you know where your groundwater enters the subsurface and you have wells downstream, you can collect samples from these wells and you can actually determine how old that water is that you sample in a well. And, you know, surprisingly, you find water that can be 10,000 years old, 20,000 years old or older. And that means a lot of this groundwater that we are drinking today is actually from 20,000 years ago. So it entered the ground that long time ago. And I took advantage in my earlier research on figuring out what we can learn about the past from these old groundwaters. So if I have a water sample from a well that's 20,000 years old, that water sample will record certain things that happened at the time when it was near the surface. For example, how cold or warm it was at the time, how much rain was falling at the time, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of parameters one can look at. And the method that gave me the most interesting results is the dissolved gas content of this water, which actually allowed me to say how cold or warm it was at the time of recharge when this water entered the ground. And I was able to say, you know, 20,000 years ago, this place in Brazil, for example, the temperature was 5 degrees C lower than it is today. So it allows me to measure the temperature in the past.
Wow. I think that's exciting stuff. And, you know, just as I could say that the water that I'm drinking is probably 20,000 years old. It's fossil water. And that means it's before the atomic residues from atomic testing and before chemicals that are polluting other people's water. So I'm happy to have it.
Yeah, it's not unusual that you drink water that is very, very old. The closest place from New York City is Atlantic City, New Jersey, right, where all the casinos are. And that water that is coming out of a fountain in a casino in Atlantic City is 20,000 years old.
Amazing. So with this CarbFix project, are you excited to be involved with something that might actually help us prevent a climate disaster, even a little?
How can I say no? Of course. Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Yeah. So it's a big step forward. And in the life of a scientist, this doesn't happen very often that you feel like you have been part of a discovery that could make a big difference.
We've been talking with Dr. Martin Stutta from Columbia University. He co-authored the paper, Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. You can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Martin, thank you for telling us a little good news for a change.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
At the 2015 World Leaders Summit in Paris, there was a lot of talk about saving the climate. But really, fossil fuel burning is only increasing. What if we do it? What if we burn the currently known reserves of reasonably accessible coal, oil, and gas? What happens to the world's climate? And could humans survive there? We know a little bit more about that thanks to a scientific letter published May 23, 2016. It's in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon. We've reached the lead author, Kasia Tokarska. She's from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of Victoria in Canada. Kasia, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your call.
Well, please tell us why you and your co-authors decided to do this research.
We think it is relevant to know what would happen if we do not take any actions to mitigate climate change. For example, if we do not ever implement the Paris Agreement or other similar agreements. Our study shows a profound climate change in the absence of further mitigation actions.
Well, we need to get to a few basics, I think. First, it's hard to imagine a trillion tons of carbon. What is the scientific sort of language for that, and how much have we burned so far?
So since the year year 1870, we have emitted about 540 gigatons of carbon, which is equivalent to a mass of 5 million Titanic ships. And if we continue a business-as-usual scenario and freely combust Earth's remaining fossil fuel resources, we might end up with a total amount of emitted 5 trillion tons of carbon, and that would be equivalent to a mass of 95 million Titanic ships. So that's a lot of carbon.
So is a gigaton a million tons?
So 1 gigaton is 1,000 tons of carbon, and 1 ton of carbon is 1,000 kilograms of carbon, if we go with the SI unit.
Okay. Now, how did your team decide about the amounts of fossil fuels we might consume?
We are just using the lower estimate of what could be the amount of fossil fuel consumed. However, with the recent technology, we don't consider those other sources such as the shale gas or other things that right now we're not using as fossil fuels, but they could be used maybe with the technology ongoing. So we're looking at the best case of the worst case scenario.
And there is a surprise in this new paper. Some previous science suggested that as we overload the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, the impact of even more, say another trillion tons, becomes less than the earlier pollution. What was the logic behind that?
Previous studies have mostly explored using simpler climate models, and those simpler climate models might not have a good representation of the some processes in the Earth system, especially the ocean heat uptake and the ocean carbon uptake. So as we know, the ocean takes up carbon and heat. So whatever we emit right now, the temperature that the global mean temperature is, whatever the global mean temperature is actually being diminished by the heat that is being taken up by the ocean. And those simpler models show that the ocean continues to take up heat even at those higher levels of carbon emitted. However, in the more complex models that we use, the ocean heat uptake actually diminishes at those higher levels of carbon emitted, which means the ocean gets saturated maybe with heat, and then it doesn't take up as much heat as it does currently. So as a result, we feel the higher net warming effect compared to those simpler models.
And how fast did your team consider we would burn that 5 million tons, or does the pace of emissions matter to the outcome?
We considered a business-as-usual scenario where we continue to emit at a rate similar to the current rate, and then 5 trillion tons of carbon emitted happens to be around year 2200, depending on the model, but in the 2200s decade.
Okay, so let's be specific. Kasia Takarska, if we burn it all, what happens to the global mean temperature?
Well, if we continue to burn Earth's remaining fossil fuel resources, the Earth will encounter a profound climate change, with the global mean warming ranging between 6.4 and 9.5 degrees Celsius. And that's a global mean warming. The regional warming can be even more profound. Most of the warming would be felt by the northern high latitudes and the Arctic, and the Arctic could warm even between 14.7 and 19.5 degrees Celsius.
That's a whole different world.
It will be very profound climate change. We focus on the physical climate change response, so we didn't really study the impacts. However, based on the other studies available right now from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report, we can say that probably some of the regions would not be habitable at this time, and there probably will not be any Arctic sea ice left in the summer.
A few years ago, when talking with scientists, they would tell me that the tropics would not warm all that much. I've heard scientists say that. Do you agree?
Well, most of the warming is felt by the northern high latitudes due to all those different processes such as the ice albedo feedback and polar amplification. The tropics are also warming as well, but not as much as the northern high latitudes.
Given the research that you've done, do you personally think there's any hope of containing global warming below the former 2 degrees safe level?
Well, I hope our research is only an what-if study, what would happen if we burn our remaining fossil fuel resources, but hopefully we will not go all the way there. And some people might say, well, year 2200, that's a long time away from now. But I think our study really shows that now is the time to act if we don't want to encounter this profound climate change later on.
Yes, my grandchild's children could be alive in 2200.
Exactly. And on a personal level, I motivate my research by a quote from Pope Francis saying, what kind of world do we want to leave for those who come after us, for the children who are now growing up? So knowing how the world could look like at 5 trillion tons of carbon emitted, we might not want to go all the way there. And right now, we still have some time to act before it is too late.
Cassia, your letter in Nature Climate Change also talks about important changes to precipitation if we burn all the fossil fuels. Can you tell us about that?
So the precipitation changes are very interesting as well because they are extreme in both ends. Some regions could experience even 4 times as high precipitation as they have right now, while other regions could experience decline in precipitation twice as little or even 3 times as little.
You're describing an incredible and dangerous world, and I presume that a global mean temperature rise between 6 and 9 degrees centigrade, with more humidity in some places, means some parts of the world could become uninhabitable. Any guesses where?
Unfortunately, yeah, we study only physical climate change, so we didn't look at the impact, so I'm not able to provide the answer for this one.
But you did reference a paper in your references by Sherwood and Huber on the limits of human survival in a hot, wet world.
Right, yeah, and they look at global mean warming up to 9 degrees, around 9 degrees Celsius, and they say some regions would not be habitable, but right now I don't remember which one.
Okay, I think from my reading, the Middle East starts out as one of the real danger zones, Abu Dhabi, places like that. Well, now, you talked about climate models, and this paper mentions 4 different climate models. Were these the variety known as CMIP5, that's the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project Phase 5 models?
So we're using comprehensive climate models. So in climate models, each component of the climate system, such as the atmosphere, ocean, land, ice sheets, can be thought of as being represented as a piece of a puzzle. And those pieces of puzzle are interconnected between each other and interact between each other. And then we look at different scenarios. So, for example, at the very high carbon emission scenario, it's like adding additional pieces of carbon puzzle and then seeing how those interactions and the final results change in response to that scenario. And because we're using comprehensive climate models from the CMIC5 project, those models have quite good representation of those different processes that happen between those different components of the climate system.
Again, following up on the references in your paper, I found the one by Friedlingstein et al. And it was talking about the difficulties of using climate models. But in that paper, they talked about, in this century, carbon emissions at about 795 to 1145 parts per million. That's double to triple what we have today. How does that fit with your research?
So parts per million, that refers to the atmospheric CO2 concentration. So in our research, we look up to around 1,200 parts per million, I think, CO2 concentration. So it's even higher levels of carbon in the atmosphere.
And that same paper also talked about the difficulties of the carbon cycle feedbacks on land. And I know that one of your co-authors, Andrew Weaver, wrote a paper in 2012 about permafrost melt. In this new work, did you account for feedbacks from a rapidly changing Arctic?
I think permafrost feedbacks are actually not included in those models yet. There are lots of recent studies trying to include the permafrost feedbacks, but the models we used didn't have it yet. And yes, the land carbon cycle especially is very difficult to be represented by the models. However, if we look at the response of the both ocean and land carbon uptake, ocean takes up most of the carbon. So the net effect of the land carbon cycle is much smaller than the ocean one. And especially at those higher levels of carbon emitted, ocean is the dominant carbon sink and heat sink. So in a way, this uncertainty doesn't really affect our results that much.
You know, I think you represent a couple of new trends I'm seeing develop in climate-related science. For one thing, we're seeing more coming from undergrads like yourself. Previously, years ago in publications, the most senior author was always listed as the lead author, even if the undergrad inspired and did most of the work. Do you think this change reflects the urgency of the climate situation? You're not a professor or a doctor as yet, are you?
No. I'm a PhD student, and I think right now the trend is that PhD students are expected to publish 3 papers in order to graduate. So what the study is definitely a collaboration effort with senior scientists, such as my second and third authors are my co-supervisors. And because I did most of the data analysis, I ended up being the first author.
But you probably don't know that years ago it didn't used to be that way. Even if you inspired it and did all the work, the senior scientist's name went on the paper as the lead author, and now that's changing. We're letting undergrads get published when they do good work.
Well, I think that's a good change.
I think so, too. And the other thing is, I'm talking to more and more women climate scientists, and I think that's great. And maybe I have a misconception, but I think that women have been generally known to think more about future generations, so this could really help us.
Oh, I think so, too. I definitely just like, in general, the trend of seeing more women in sciences. I did my undergraduate degree in physics, and definitely it would be nice to have more, seeing more women students during that time. So, yeah, so definitely I think it would be good to have an equal ratio.
And getting back to your new paper, The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon, what has been the response?
We got a lot of media coverage, actually, on this paper, which is really great. We got articles in The Guardian, National Geographic website, and I was really happy to see that people are very interested in our study. And it's great because knowing what would happen if we end up burning Earth's fossil fuel resources, we might actually maybe raise more awareness, and those people who read those articles might be able to change their own behaviors. And then if everybody just contributes a little bit, we might be able to have a change on a global scale.
And Cassia, once you know the worst place we can go, and that's what this paper is sort of about, what do you tell your friends about the future?
Well, I would say now is the time to act.
Yeah, this is almost kind of activist science in a way.
I think we're living in a crucial time right now because what the Paris Agreement is about, limiting the global mean warming at 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial level. However, currently we're nearly around the 1 degree above it. So we have very little room to even reach the goal of the Paris Agreement. So it is very crucial time we're right now in. And if we don't take any prompt actions to limit emissions, we'll just keep going down this road. And our study shows the worst case scenario in the case.
And as we finish up, what new scientific research interests you the most?
Well, in my previous research during my master's, I actually looked at the opposite case. Is it possible to undo climate change? So, for example, if we emit carbon to the atmosphere, but then we use net negative emission technologies to remove this carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that we emitted, can we undo climate change? And I found it very interesting to see that global mean temperature actually is somewhat easy to reverse. However, other components of the climate system, such as sea level, continue to rise despite those negative emission effects. I find it very interesting to see those different scenarios and what would happen if we do this or that. And as much as negative emission technologies might be necessary to actually reach those global temperature climate goals, we should not put fully our faith in it because they cannot substitute our efforts just to stop emitting right now.
What you said is incredibly important, I think. We've been talking with another bright mind developing in the climate community. Cassia Tokarska is from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of Victoria in Canada. She's the lead author of the science letter, The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon, as published in the journal Nature Climate Change. You can find links to this science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for your call.
Here's a short interview from the Australian radio maker Phil Stubbs as he talks with visiting scholar Stefan Ramsdorf of the Potsdam Institute.
So, Stefan, is the long, hot summer that we've been experiencing connected to climate change?
Yes, it is. It's part of a general warming trend, which has increased the number of heat records around the world quite dramatically. We have looked at this at our institute, and we now get 5 times more monthly heat records around the world than you would in an unchanging climate. And, of course, in Sydney, we have just experienced a record-breaking long spell of temperatures above 26 degrees that's been going on for more than 5 weeks now and has doubled the previous record long spell of such warm temperatures. And nationwide in Australia, a new record for March temperatures was set that was a full degree centigrade warmer than the previous record. Those are quite stunning numbers.
It's not just here in Australia, is it? Because globally, we've had record-breaking years for temperature globally. And in fact, I've heard it said that global warming's going into overdrive. Is it, in fact, speeding up?
Well, we had 2014 set a new global heat records We had 2015, another new global hottest year on record, and now we have the beginning of 2016 coming out with these really stunning numbers. The February this year was a full 1.35 degrees warmer than the climatological baseline period in the middle of the 20th century. And up until last September, we had never had an anomaly of more than 1 degree, and now we are suddenly at 1.35 degree. That's the biggest jump upward that we have seen. That's not entirely unexpected because we have a major El Niño event ongoing in the tropical Pacific. It's now kind of slowly winding down. And we know from past experience that these El Niño events, they put an extra spike of warming on top of the long-term ongoing global warming trend, which is caused by greenhouse gases.
Stefan, what's going to be the effect of these kinds of increases? Do we really know what to expect from here?
Well, in terms of the temperature, we will see this warm spike going back again when the El Niño subsides. It's going to last a couple more months and then it will be basically over. But the much more worrying underlying warming trend will continue into the future because it is caused undoubtedly by our emissions of greenhouse gases, mainly carbon dioxide. And as long as we haven't stopped emitting carbon dioxide, this global warming will continue. And it has major impacts. We can already see this just this past month with this record temperature. We had a very severe drought in Vietnam. We had very severe drought in Zimbabwe, for example. We had this Category 5 typhoon hitting Fiji. And all these were events that caused major damage as a percentage of the GDP to these countries.
Stefan, your own country of Germany has made significant shifts away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. Can you give the listener a sense of what's happening in Germany?
Yeah, I think the German government has for many years been very aware that we are facing a climate crisis. You could actually call it a climate emergency. And the way to stop global warming is to get out of fossil fuels. And I think Germany has made some pretty good progress together with other countries like Denmark. Just to give you a number, the gross electricity production in Germany last year came 30% from renewable sources. And that's up from nearly nothing about 15 years ago. And if you look at Europe as a whole, the investments into new electricity generating capacity in Europe last year went to 77% into renewables. So the age of fossil fuels is clearly coming to an end and investors are moving away from that and investing in renewable energy because they know that is where the future lies.
What's your view of how Australia's going? So you've been here since last year, and I know you've been here before. So we've got a lot of potential here, but we've also got a lot of wealth in the form of fossil fuels in the ground. So can you see us walking away from that, and how can we do it?
Well, it's a fact that in Paris in December, a climate agreement was reached to stop global warming well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures. And that simply means that about 80% of the fossil fuel reserves that we know have to remain in the ground. So there's no question about using that kind of wealth, if you like, that's sitting in the ground there. And I think Australia will also have to face up to that reality that basically coal is dying. The old coal economy is collapsing and we are seeing the emergence of a new age of renewable energies. And in fact, Australia is, of course, much better placed than Germany. Australia has vast solar energy resources, for example. In Germany, where I live, it's 54 degrees north, so it's much closer to the pole than to the equator. It's very cloudy in the Berlin area, and the solar panels on my roof are generating twice as much electricity over the year as my family uses. And Australia, of course, is far better placed to harvest solar energy and also wind energy than Germany is.
That was climate scientist Stefan Ramsdorf, interviewed in Australia by Phil Stubbs from theenvironmentshow.com. We're out of time for this program. Thank you for caring about your world. Please tune in to Radio EcoShock again next week.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And yeah, you're right, we're going to talk about Muhammad Ali. And we're also going to be talking some about the developments in Syria with Rick Sterling. On Muhammad Ali, we're going to be talking to Ishmael Reed, the author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. Probably, and it is, in my view, the most complete. Covers so many aspects of his life that are being talked about now. And we'll get into all that. But, hey, I have a little song for you, sung by the man himself, Muhammad Ali. And there's another guy named Sam Cooke.
Sam Cooke, as you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here. And Sam and I, we expect to have this out in another week or so.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Well, I want to give you a little introduction. Only this record is talking about, you know, me, the greatest, and the various people in countries such as England and Paris. And we'll give them a sound.
Come on, let's give them a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We'll try now.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one. Do it again now. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Is New York with me?
Yeah.
Is Chicago with me?
Yeah.
Is London with me?
Yeah.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We gonna swing as one.
How you like that?
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And there were two famous singers, Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke. Among the many, many things that are being talked about and said is you need to remember is Sam Cooke, one of the greatest voices, singers in all, anywhere, anytime, any culture. And he and this remarkable individual, Muhammad Ali, were dear friends. Not just, you know, they didn't just wave at each other in airports. They were, these guys were pals. And Sam Cooke, unfortunately, like there's so much in American history, there's something dark and dangerous going on at all times. And it's rooted in difficult subjects, speaking the word root. We now have roots is once again being shown to the American people. And once again, there's a difference of opinion. What are we trying to talk about? There's a lot of pain, and there's always, who is the audience? Who is, it's like Muhammad Ali was asked by Roger Ebert. I recommend you go and look at this, by the way. Roger Ebert was a famous film critic, Chicago, pretty smart guy. And he had an idea. He saw the movie Rocky, and he thought, why should I just look at Rocky? Why don't I ask an expert? And he found himself, he arranged to be with Muhammad Ali while they watched the film Rocky II. And Apollo Creed, etc., is the villain. And so he asked Ali to tell him, to comment on the film. Two things he wanted from him talking about that film. And I raise this ugly subject of the Rocky films because Ali said, I win the title, and they make a film about a white guy who wins the title. And by the way, apropos of our coming interview with Rick Sterling, there is a... this is a habit. The U.S. has got to ask itself some questions. We've got to get Dr. Freud to sit, get America to lie down and talk about some things. Why is it when you lose the wars, you win them, you lose the war, the actual war, and then you win the movie? You have a lot of movies where you keep winning. You take Mr. Stallone. He knows where the ugly, exposed nerves of the culture are. So he created a guy, Rambo, who, after they actually lose in Vietnam, he goes back and wins in Vietnam. So you have a black champion who's beautiful and talented and all these things, and there are people who are itching to do something. And so he makes a movie of a white champion, and he calls him Rocky. Now, he didn't call him Rocky for no reason. He called him Rocky because the last white champion of any note was Rocky Marciano. So we all understood that. And there's another matter, is that he said, and this is true, he got the idea to make the film when he saw a journeyman fighter, Chuck Wepner, look it up, Chuck Wepner, who was fighting Muhammad Ali, and he was journeyman, and Ali was dancing and working on him, and at one point, Wepner did something, sometimes it's an accident, sometimes it's on purpose. He stepped on Ali's foot as Ali was moving. At the same time, he threw a punch. I think he hit him in the chest. At any rate, Ali fell down. And according to Stallone, what happened next was the crowd leaped to its feet in delirium because the black champion had fallen. And they thought, they were praying that Chuck Wepner was going to prevail or something. I don't know. They must have been dreaming, and as they were. And, of course, Ali got up and whipped Wepner. But Stallone said that was his epiphany to make the movie. He knew that you're going to sell out every movie house in America if you can create a white Rocky figure who beats up a black man with bravado. And so he gave a fantasy. And Ali, visiting Roger Ebert, said that. Ebert said, what do you think of this film and the ending? And he said, well, you have to understand, white America cannot have a narrative where I prevail. That's me in the movie. That's clear to me. And so that's where we are. I mentioned that, we have things called Black Lives Matter. We have all these shootings of unarmed black Americans. And at the same time, Bill Clinton is going to show up at the graveside of Muhammad Ali and give a speech. And you say, I don't know, have we really, how far have we gotten down the road here? This is, so all kinds of people who have destroyed the lives of black Americans are standing and saying, oh yes, Ali, I loved him, I thought he was great. Very strange. And so as I say, Dr. Freud needs to put America on the couch and talk about this. If you're a fight fan, as I hope that's part of your understanding, is just how good he was. He made some telling remarks that I want to say, since we're going to we'll be talking to Ishmael Reed about this later on. But Ali said, "Of course, Stallone's not a fighter." He says, Ebert said, "How real is this?" He says, "Well, he's not a fighter." He says, you can tell at a glance. He says, I know it's a good movie. By the way, he said he liked the movie. I mean, Ali is a very subtle mind. Yeah, I liked the movie. He said, I like all those. It's good. But he says, not true. And he said, the guy who in the film, they have a sparring match where Rocky, the white champion, is working out. And he's got a black fighter opposite him. And Ali said, that man actually is a fighter. He said, I can tell by the way he moves. He says he actually is a fighter. For those of you who fantasize being fighters, always remember there are real fighters, and then there are what you have going on in your head. You find out in about 3 seconds if you get anywhere near them. They once asked George Chiavallo about all the fighters in the NHL, and he just laughed. He said maybe one of them. He said Gordie Howe might have been a fighter. He said the rest of those guys, it's just sad. Of course, they asked him about Will Smith playing Muhammad Ali, and he said, I had trouble with that because he said, I have trouble believing that a guy whose neck looks like a stack of dimes is a fighter. This is not the proper, physique. I'm going around and about, but this is to highlight the fact that we are today going to be talking to Ishmael Reed, author of The Complete Muhammad Ali, and it is a book that just recently published, in which he dealt with every single matter that probably on your mind. I'll say that again, the death of Ali has created a kind of earthquake, and we're going to have aftershocks for quite a while. Incidentally, Ishmael Reed has an op-ed article in the June 4, 2016 New York Times, and it was published the day following the death of Muhammad Ali. It is timely. It is titled Worshipped, Misunderstood, Exploited, and that's something to mark.
Savage cannibal maniacs miss me? I bet you did. This is probably only temporary, so I gotta make this count. Back in September, someone at the FBI learned how to read and found out I was running for president. He or she shared the news with everyone else at the fascist bozos of intimidation, and immediately panic spread. They got a hold of Trainwreck Trevor, who was their Ohio prison surrogate, and the baby oil application specialist at their office naked twister parties on Tuesdays. Trevor immediately flipped the switch on all of my communications mediums. Now I'm the only presidential candidate in history silenced by the FBI. You know what that means. It means the HireArc program is so unstable and so fragile that even its most ardent attack dogs recognize that if the zombies participating in this useless electoral process realized they had the chance to vote for me and scrap the whole system, they'd do it. They'd flush the whole thing like a goldfish. You know they would. So the FBI has done what hierarchs always do when confronted by better ideas that challenge the legitimacy of their delusion. They wrap the messenger in duct tape and toss him in the basement. It's what you got to do when you are morally and intellectually bankrupt. You know they are. Keep in mind I had a 2.2 grade point average in high school and had a job pumping gas when I got locked up. If I'm really a threat to civilization, then it's doomed anyway. Might as well tip this cow and move on. Silencing me has been a mixed bag, it seems. While they've excluded me from the radio show, which we all know is the 5 minutes when everyone takes a bathroom break anyway, some really fun stuff has developed. First, we've got Swain 2016 t-shirts available, and I think you can order them from SeanSwain.org. They come in three colors, black, Mars black, and Anarchy black. Apart from the fact that they have my ugly mug on them, I've got a face for radio. They're quite fashionable, as well as flammable. So, you can wear them while tipping over cop cars, or stuff them into the mouths of vodka bottles, light them, and give it a good heave. There's just so many uses for Swain 2016 t-shirts. Everyone on the planet seeking liberation should wear one, and then we'll eat everyone who isn't. Problem solved. Second, besides the fantastic t-shirts produced by PDX ABC, a more recent development. I smuggled out communications to supporters who shared my communique with Donald Trump's campaign. In it, I related how JWoww can't even get his cabinet member's home address off of blastblog.noblogs.org. So how can JWoww be trusted to defeat ISIS? The Trump campaign was all over it. They planned to use it. So JWoww, having pledged on Tuesday that he was in the race until the convention, suspended his campaign on Wednesday without an explanation. Now you know the whole scoop. I did that. And now there's a roster of JWoww's entire staff posted at prisoner support sites along with their office phone numbers and email addresses. Feel free to contact all 70 of them to tell them how you feel about them suspending my communications after they hear this and shut me down again. Anyone out there looking to help me get elected can start by getting some awesome endorsements. I don't mean endorsements by, like, the Chamber of Commerce or George Clooney. I mean endorsements from the Earth Liberation Front, the Cleveland Four, Marius Mason, Jeremy Hammond, Anonymous, and maybe even Blastblog. For fascists who torture people, these people sure get their feelings hurt easily. We can expect that I'll be silenced again any minute now. Imagine how they're going to feel when I get sworn in as president, with my right hand raised and my left one resting on a can of gasoline. Never forget, gas is cheap, matches are free. This is anarchist prisoner and presidential candidate Sean Swain, and I approve this message.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we have another fabulous show with another fabulous guest. We'll be welcoming back Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly writes a weekly column, Margaret Kimberly's Freedom Writer, for the Black Agenda Report. And we all love the Black Agenda Report. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. It's great to be back.
Well, thank you. I know my listeners are familiar with the Black Agenda Report and with your work, but can you just briefly tell us a little bit about it for those who may not be familiar with it?
Sure. BlackAgendaReport.com is a 10-year-old internet magazine. And as we say, we give news and analysis from a black left perspective, and we mean left. We don't mean Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
People would say it's radical. I'll accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we are opposed to the Democratic Party and to Barack Obama. We did not change our tune because someone who looked like us was the new president. And write about, I think we're the only news magazine for writing about issues involving the African diaspora where we have all original reporting. We do link to what other people do, but we are primarily doing original reporting on subjects domestic and international.
Right, and many of us on the left have really appreciated the principled stand you've taken against really the imperialism, fascism, racism, and so many things that have really taken a back seat since, well, not just since Obama's become president, but since about 2007, when the Democrats regained, the majority in Congress, it seemed like all of a sudden many things that were very, protested so much when Bush when the Republicans were in power, seemed to just not be so important anymore.
Well, yeah, it's like we have nothing to show for the first 2 years of Obama's term. He was president, Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress. And we were told that, that's all we needed and Democrats could do anything they wanted. Uh-huh. And if anybody questions or criticizes, all we're told is look at Obamacare. And that's it. And Obamacare is problematic. It enshrines the profit motive in healthcare, which is the problem with American healthcare. And the fact that it's attacked by the right wing so relentlessly does not mean that it's a good thing.
Right.
The Democrats can't even, for example, now because of mass action from workers, all claim they want the minimum wage to be $15 an hour. Well, they had a chance to make the minimum wage anything they wanted in 2009, the federal minimum wage went up a grand total of 70 cents with Democrats in office. So
incredible.
Wars continue regardless of whether there's a Democrat or Republican in the White House, and Democrats protect and defend a Democratic president and do not present any critique, any analysis, any opposition. It's you have to go with him, and the Republicans are so mean. So everybody's silent. And I feel like we're worse off, frankly, when we have Democratic presidents because people just shut themselves down.
Well, what has been so frustrating to me lately, and the reason I invited you back on was because you wrote an article about it. It's not frustrating to me that people are out protesting Trump. I think people should be. I think people should be out protesting Clinton. I think people should be out protesting Sanders. Mm-hmm. And, if people cared about, imperialism, if people cared about these wars, if people cared about brown people being murdered all over the world, they would be out very strongly, like they have been protesting Trump. They'd be out protesting Clinton and Sanders, too. But Trump actually hasn't really, from an official position in the U.S. government, killed anybody. So you wrote an article called Who's the Fascist? And so that's why I invited you on, because it puts so well into words what's been frustrating me lately.
Yeah, the word fascist is overused.
Right.
Anyone that people find objectionable in some way, they call a fascist. And I just want to say, I believe Trump is a racist. I believe the people who love him are drawn to the fact that he is open, makes that open appeal to white nationalism. And I don't have a problem with people objecting to or protesting him.
Right.
But I called my article Who's a Fascist because I wondered what you just brought up. It doesn't matter what Obama or any previous Democratic or Republican presidents have done, no matter how awful, no matter how many people they kill. It doesn't seem to matter. They're never called fascists. I had a laundry list of countries where American presidents or U.S. allies have killed people. It ranges from Serbia and Kosovo to Somalia and Iran and Libya and Pakistan and Grenada and Haiti, and the list goes on and on and on. And I said, you know, what do you have to do to be a fascist, to be called a fascist?
Right.
We are told that, you know, Obama, oh, he was a constitutional law professor. Well, apparently he forgot everything he taught because he has made more of an assault on our civil liberties than even Bush did. We still have the Patriot Act. They strengthened the Patriot Act. He goes after whistleblowers with the Espionage Act, something from Woodrow Wilson's era that was scarcely used until he came to office. The way Edward Snowden was treated. Edward Snowden was seeking asylum, which was his right under domestic and international law. But it was violated in an effort to snatch him up because he spilled the beans. The kill list, the assassinations. There's no legislation, no case law, nothing that says an American president has the right to declare somebody an enemy combatant and kill them. Bush didn't claim the right to kill people. He claimed the right to imprison people. Mm-hmm. Obama took it one step further and killed Anwar al-Awlaki and his son. But Congress didn't say anything. The corporate media didn't say anything. The attorney general made public statements about some... you know, how due process doesn't mean what we seem to think it means.
Mm-hmm.
So if that isn't fascism, I don't know what is. It's a part of a larger problem where the anti-war protests during the Bush era were more anti-Republican than they were really anti-war. And Obama marketed himself as an anti-war candidate, and that silenced people who call themselves leftist or progressive, and they've remained largely silent to this day.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, so Trump has, for sure, like you said, he is appealing to the lowest denominator of some segments of our society with his rhetoric. But Obama has deported more immigrant workers and in any other president before him. People aren't burning things down at his rallies or his public appearances.
Absolutely, and they should be. He's the number one border. He's the number one killer. The mass incarceration state has not diminished at all on his watch. He does pretend things like, you know, he'll make a documentary and he'll pardon, like, you know, 10 or 20 people or however many. And he could have given the people sentenced to prison under the draconian crack cocaine sentencing rules, he could have given them the right to request resentencing, but he denied it. And that's the sort of thing he does, and he gets away with it. I remember when Reagan was president, people said he had Teflon. He could get away with anything,
right,
and nothing stuck to him. Well, oh, he has nothing on Obama. So, yes, people should be protesting him about any number of issues. Trump's most guilty of being boorish and classless and graceless and not hiding his racism. There's no doubt in my mind that Hillary Clinton is equally racist. I am convinced of that. She doesn't say so, but he comes out and says it. And so that is his biggest crime, is not silencing his racism, not hiding it, or his misogyny, or any of the other things. He's the worst of all possible worlds. He's born into a rich family, never did anything else, and got away with saying and doing whatever he wanted to do. And it shows. And that's nobody I want to be the president or even a, you know, guest at a dinner party.
Right.
But it's not a reason to say that someone is actually a fascist. And in some ways, he's so unpredictable, it's hard to say what he would really do. But he's to the left of Hillary Clinton on foreign policy. He has said what somebody ought to say. Why does the United States have to run the whole world? Why do we spend so much money on NATO? His emphasis is on money. It's not my politics.
Right.
So we have to make Russia an enemy. And by the way, the United States, Obama's, it seems, is trying his best to start World War III with NATO putting troops in the countries along Russia's border. And Trump has questioned why that should be done. Trump has said, I'm not going to cut Social Security. And Democrats are always trying to get away with doing that. He said the minimum wage should be higher. So that's not something that would make me vote for him. I, as a black person especially, I'm uncomfortable with someone who is so attractive to rednecks. And rednecks aren't necessarily, you know, meth heads living in trailer parks. Rednecks can wear suits and ties and work on Wall Street. But that mentality, right, who's so right. attractive to people of that mentality, it would be difficult for me to overlook that. But he is not worse than Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. Bill Clinton ended welfare as a right. Welfare was an entitlement for 60 years until Bill Clinton did away with it. Mm-hmm. It's something that Republicans fantasized about, a Democrat actually did. So that's the sort of thing that people need to remember in concluding that the real thing is this duopoly, which is so toxic. It needs to go, and the Democratic Party needs to go. It needs to be destroyed. And a lesser evil, and Bernie's better than Hillary, and I guess he is, but it's kind of damning with faint praise. But he doesn't really want to do anything radical. He's not really a socialist. He keeps saying that he'll endorse her if she gets the nomination instead of him. So that's not the answer. The answer is for the Democratic Party to be done. And the first step is to stop voting for them, not to be traumatized by Gore losing to Bush in 2000, but to realize that these people, the Democratic Party, does not have our interests in mind, and we aren't even on their agenda. And the sooner they go, the better off we will be.
Absolutely. The thing that like really gets me is, first of all, I think that this election is just bizarre. But you know, people are saying it's that the election shows that people here in the United States are tired of business as usual, because Trump has taken the Republican nomination and Sanders is putting up a fight for the Democratic nomination. But I really think that Sanders wouldn't be doing as well as he is if he hadn't re-registered a Democrat, and if he hadn't been promising all along that he's there not to destroy the Democratic Party, but to make it better. And right. So I think that his candidacy reflects more of a bent towards the status quo than Trump's, for sure.
Yes, it does. Trump has blown up the Republican Party. It's pretty clear that the rank-and-file Republicans and independents who end up voting Republican in presidential elections, they had no allegiance to the Republican Party platform of the trade deals. And somebody should attack these trade deals. Americans have lost jobs because of them. Mm-hmm. That's one of the ways in which he is to the left of Democratic leadership, who push these horrible things on us and the rest of the world. So yes, absolutely. White working class people are losing out. Excuse me. And so they were looking, of course they were attracted to someone who was a celebrity, first of all, they knew who he was, and who said the things that they felt. And I'm not going to necessarily criticize someone because they want a president who says, we've got to stop these trade deals. That actually does make sense. So all the things that Republicans, you know, smaller government and lower taxes and all these things that Republicans won, it's very clear millions of their voters didn't really care. And so they were attracted to Republicans because of an unspoken, I believe, an unspoken racism. There's always, as we say at Black Agenda Report, a white people's party. And at one time it was the Democrats of the segregated South, but for the past 40 years or so it's been the Republicans. That, I think, was the appeal of the Republican Party and not anything they were selling. So, and Trump has proven that. So I think it's a good thing for the Republican Party to be imploding, and we need to make sure the same thing happens with the Democrats, because Hillary Clinton is already doing is moving to the right, and she's going to try to attract those Republicans who just can't stomach Trump. But what does that say for the Democratic Party? What will the Democratic Party be?
Right.
It'll be more right-wing than it is now. I've always said, before this year, I said we have a far-right party and a center-right party. And the Democrats won't even be center-right if Hillary Clinton gets in. So she's already making those appeals, and we'll see it anymore in a general election campaign.
I love how you said that when Clinton said, you made a Facebook status, Clinton said something about if Trump gets in, the Kremlin's going to love it. And you're like, yay, that would be wonderful.
It would be. I was half joking.
Right.
They're risking world. I'm not exaggerating this.
Right.
This, you know, peacemaker president, and he's, you know, Obama's going on this, I call it his imperialism tour. So he goes to Hiroshima, meets atomic bomb survivors, and hugs this old guy. And
terrible.
But he is building more nuclear warheads right. than any other president and putting them right on Russia's border. So the Russians would be happy if Trump were president. But as far as foreign policy is concerned, I'd be happier if somebody who espoused that point of view could become president. So yes, the manipulations and the outright lies and propaganda that we've been given about Russia is just horrendous, and it shows how the corporate media, especially with foreign policy, just follows the White House line. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. The New York Times will say we need to attack Iraq when Bush is president, and now they repeat the caricatures of Putin that are used to dehumanize him and the Russians. So should the day come that there is not just a cold war, but a hot war, that Americans will be in favor of it.
Well, and it's just funny that the so-called socialist Bernie Sanders and, you know, Hillary Clinton, who represents, like you said, we used to be able to consider it maybe the center party, but now it's center-right. You know, mm-hmm. but many people think she's liberal. How they have engaged in red baiting when Sanders called Hugo Chavez the dead communist dictator.
Yeah,
his thing. So they're supposed to be so left, and they're actually participating in this propaganda, which isn't surprising.
No, and Sanders says the same thing. We've got to contain Putin's aggression. It's not Putin's the one who's aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Western nations have been encroaching on Russia for the past 20 years, adding NATO members and instigating a coup in Ukraine. So Putin's been defensive and reactive. The ones who need to be contained are the ones in Washington and in London and Paris. But it's like Sanders, first of all, doesn't seem that interested in foreign policy. Initially, his campaign website didn't say anything about foreign policy.
Right.
But then when he started talking about it, he's saying the same thing, and he'll say something like, Palestinians deserve dignity. Well, no, they need their land back. They need an end to occupation. They need to stop being killed by Israel. But he never goes that far. He supports the same things Hillary does. He is not as mendacious as she is. But unfortunately, the other thing I don't like about Sanders, I don't even think he wants to win.
Right.
He could have made a big deal. The first debate, he says, I don't want to talk about these emails. That's a big story.
Right.
The Secretary of State was clearly trying to hide something by using a personal email to do State Department business. That Clinton Fund or Clinton Initiative, whatever it is a cesspool of influence peddling. And I'm convinced that's what she was hiding. But if you're trying to beat someone, why wouldn't you bring that up? Why wouldn't you make that an issue? So, I've got issues. I'm not feeling the burn at all for a variety of reasons.
I told someone if they were still feeling the burn, they have penicillin for that. They could go take something. Your colleague, Bruce Dixon, said, I don't know, maybe over a year ago, that Sanders was a sheep herder for the Democratic Party. Now we're closer to the DNC, the convention in Philly in July. And what do you see happening? I think, do you just like foresee what usually happens? The people fight really hard for their so-called, different candidate, the savior. They fight really hard for them, and they swear they're not going to vote for the or support the the other person, if they're the nominee. What do you think, what do you foresee happening? Will all of these Sandinistas just flow seamlessly into the Clinton camp after she gets a nomination?
It's hard to say how many will. Some will, but I think some will stay out. I don't know if they'll vote for Trump. I think they will. Some will stay home,
mm-hmm.
vote for the Green Party and the likely candidate Jill Stein. But I don't think people are going to follow as readily as they used to. I think there will be an attempt to get them there, and I think Sanders will. You know, we took a lot of heat for calling him the sheepdog, and people got very mad, and why are you saying that, and blah, you know. But so far, he's proven us correct.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say how many people. I don't think it will be as many people as have done so in the past, as when Jesse Jackson ran, or Dennis Kucinich, or other people on the left wing of the Democratic Party. I don't think it's going to be so seamless this time. But I think Sanders will end up doing what we predicted.
But even if it's Trump, you know, it is Trump. It is Trump. And so I think, I don't even want to guess a percentage. I think at least 90% are going to be, and I think many of these people, Margaret, are supporting Sanders in the primaries until they get to the voting booth, and then they vote for Clinton.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard for people. They're already raising the, you know, Ralph Nader cost Gore the White House, and it's only June.
Right.
So between now and November, that drumbeat will get louder and louder from these, you know, late night comedians, what's his name, Colbert, apparently did some routine about, you know, you don't want to be like Nader in 2000.
Jeez.
You know, Robert Reich saying, vote your conscience, but really don't vote your conscience. Just fall in line and vote for Hillary. So I think that pressure is going to be there. But I think it remains to be seen. I think there'll be more people who will just say to heck with it and not go along. But it's hard to predict the number.
Right. I just want to shift gears a little bit because I told you I wanted to talk about that article and other things. I spent the weekend with a very good friend of mine, David Swanson,
mm-hmm.
and we did some events. We did like 3 events. And David has a book, War is a Lie, and David's a pacifist, and that's the only thing that we disagree about, you know, because I'm not a pacifist. I believe in liberation struggles, and I even believe in armed liberation struggles. But I went to your Facebook page, and I don't ever remember, did you just put up that picture of Robert and Mabel Williams on your...
Oh, I've had it. I've had it for a while.
I just noticed it. I watched the documentary Negroes with Guns, and I read his book after I watched the documentary. And can you tell my listeners about him? Because to me, I was so inspired by that documentary. I couldn't even tell you. And I'm very ashamed because up until I watched it, I had never heard of him.
Well, he's one of many people that we should all know more about.
Absolutely.
He was in the 60s. He is a man who advocated self-defense. And this was at the time that King was advocating nonviolence. And so as hard as it was at that time, he and, you know, if you look at my the cover photo of my timeline page, it's a photo from his book of the Williamses holding guns. And he ended up leaving the country for a while. He lived in China. He lived in Cuba. He came back to the United States where he passed away. But he always talked about self-defense, and hence the title of his book, Negroes with Guns. And it was that sort of activism that I think he predated, actually, the Black Panther Party.
Yes.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense,
mm-hmm.
Which was successful, which was why it was destroyed by the COINTEL program by J. Edgar Hoover, who used a variety of techniques, getting people to snitch, creating conflicts, killing people, getting people to kill each other because they were so popular and because people were behind them in the struggle for self-defense and to fight for, literally fight for justice and for change. So, so yes, I think it's an important distinction. When I first started writing and first started my activism, it was during the days leading up to the invasion of Iraq. And at the time, I was an anti-war person. I'm against, mm-hmm. I'll put it this way, I'm against still against the U.S. intervening in the affairs of other countries.
Right.
But I believe in the right of other people to defend themselves and of countries to defend themselves. A lot of people on the left are, in the case of Syria, for example, they say, well, I'm not pro-Assad. And I'm like, well, I am. I don't live in Syria. I don't know what it's like to live under his government, but he has a right to defend his country. It's a sovereign nation, and for him to just give up and give the bully his lunch money,
right,
and let the U.S. and their allies among the Gulf states and NATO just say, okay, you can have my country. Is wrong. I'll just use the word wrong. And it's a good thing that he has held out. It's a good thing that Russia finally came to his aid. And I will always defend nations who defend themselves from attack by the U.S.
And we should. As, you know, revolutionaries, we should be in solidarity with those struggles. Well,
but everyone's not a revolutionary, and I think that's the difference.
What?
Everyone's not a revolutionary.
Right.
Some people just want a little change, nibbling around the edges, let's reform things. But to call oneself a revolutionary is not something that a lot of people who are anti-U.S. wars are willing.
Well, that's the soapbox for this week. As always, I hoped you were informed and inspired to check out more. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Margaret Kimberly, like I said, for her work and her continuing adherence to principles. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.
January 1942, when the baby, Cassius Marcellus Clay, Jr., was born to a working-class Negro family in Louisville, Kentucky. In those days, Kentucky was famous for its distinctive bluegrass, its championship horses, and its whiskey. None knew that the brown boy born to the Clays would become one of the most famous and most revered men in the world. In 1960, at 178 pounds, Clay would win an Olympic gold medal as a talented light heavyweight amateur. For many, that's more than enough for a place in history. But a mere 4 years later, he would stun the world by defeating the dreaded Sonny Liston, a man few expected him to beat, to become heavyweight champion of the world. Soon thereafter, he would announce his conversion to the Nation of Islam and his acceptance of a new holy name, Muhammad Ali. The world would come to know and remember him today by that name, and he would emerge as the biggest, boldest personality in the world of sport. We forget today how his name, his faith, and his steadfast refusal to fight for the American Empire in Vietnam marked him as one of the most hated men in America. We have forgotten how his fights occasioned many, many death threats against the world's heavyweight champ. When the World Boxing Association stripped him of his title in 1967 Many thought this was the end of his career. For refusing military enlistment, he faced 5 years in prison. But he sued all the way to the Supreme Court and won. In the interim, however, almost 4 years had passed, and these were the prime years of a boxer. In 1974, he regained his title and won it again in 1978 before retiring a year later. He dazzled his opponents and fans by his uncanny hand speed and his fancy footwork, which became known as the Ali Shuffle. He was a beautiful fighter, not simply because he was a beautiful man, but for an athlete of his impressive size, he danced around the ring and developed the fighting style that carried him through an outstanding career. In 1975, he said boldly and somewhat presciently, "I am America, only I'm the part you won't recognize. But get used to me, black, confident, cocky. My name, not yours. My religion, not yours. My goals, my own. Get used to me." And guess what? The world got used to him. He lived through 74 springs and became a beloved living legend. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Begins anew, and voila, a billionaire is pitted against a millionaire. The Trump-Clinton battle, what I've earlier called the nasty versus the crafty, is a contest between cousins, for no matter who wins, as the old gambling adage goes, the house never loses. What house? The House of Capital. In the classic text, the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Frederick Engels begin their work with the startling insight. The state, they argue, is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. Looking at society from the tail end of the 19th century, both men saw the political class as but instruments of the ruling class, the capitalists. What would they make of Donald J. Trump, billionaire politician, or of Hillary Clinton, a multi-millionaire? They would both be scratching their heads in wonder. The bourgeoisie, a fancy French word for the wealthy capitalist class. They used to buy their politicians, or at least rent them. No longer. Now they've cut out the middlemen. They take power in their own name. And if you think billionaires or even millionaires really care about working or even poor people, well, let me just say, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. Cheap. This is an election in which no matter who wins, capital takes the prize. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. friends, my brothers, my sisters. It ain't over till it's over, but there is some motion. It means that we are moving closer to, hopefully, some real treatment, not of my symptoms, but of my disease. I thank you all for being there, and freedom is a constant struggle. I love you all. From what used to be Death Row, this is Mumia, your brother.
Islamophobia is rearing its ugly head here at Warren Correctional. Really, it's been something of a staple of the prison complex dating back to the events leading up to the Lucasville uprising. Back then, prison officials provoked Muslim prisoners by refusing basic accommodations and contributing to even greater tension. When prison officials' nonsense eventually sparked a riot, as part distraction and part spectacle, they framed up Muslim prisoners as leaders of the riot, going so far as to doctor surveillance recordings in order to frame Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, a Muslim prisoner at Lucasville. Sadiq has been on death row ever since, even though experts confirmed that the audio recordings used to put him there were spliced, adding Sadiq into conversations where he wasn't actually present. Yes, Ohio prison officials will go to crazy lengths in order to assassinate Muslim prisoners. Here at Warren Correctional, prison officials haven't proposed killing Muslims yet. But they do possess the heavy equipment to dig the mass grave in the softball diamond, so stay tuned. The latest round of Islamophobic attacks began when mailroom and commissary staff conspired to convince Muslim prisoners that a 30-year policy providing for the purchase of prayer oil was rescinded, when it really wasn't. The lie they told was that prisoners at some other prison were using modified pop cans and desk lamps to burn prayer oil as incense, and as a consequence, prayer oil was banned. It wasn't, of course, but nobody knew that. Recent inquiries to central office revealed that the policy hasn't changed at all. Of course, Muslims have been prevented from prayer oil purchases for months and months, and there still is no clarification as to how Muslim prisoners can go about obtaining it. So the effective ban will likely continue for several more months. Nothing at all has been done to the staff who foreclosed on Muslims' religious rights through fraud. At the same time, prison staffers banned prayer on the recreation yard. While on its face such a ban seems inclusive to every religion, consider that prayer, for everyone but Muslims, can be done inconspicuously. For Muslims, the process of prayer involves a specific ritual of standing and bowing and prostrations, actions that are identifiable as prayer. So when Mustafa Harwell attempted to pray on the recreation yard, he was surrounded by staff and roughly led away. When he wrote up a complaint about it, they called him a gang member and sent him off to Lucasville. He's in K-Block now. So the ODRC, as part of its rehabilitative program, designed to instill greater respect for law, has suspended the Constitution and enforced prayer-free zones. No member of other religions are faced with gang transfers for praying, but Muslims are. Simultaneous to banning prayer oil through fraud and cracking down on communication with Allah, the ODRC refuses to provide Muslims a religious diet, referred to as an halal diet. This is the Muslim equivalent to the Jewish kosher diet. The irony is, the ODRC recognizes kosher diet in policy while denying the Islamic equivalent entirely. All of this taken together gives Muslim prisoners the distinct impression that the ODRC holds a grudge. The situation exemplifies the prison hierarchy's silliness, their sneaky provocations that originate from some really deep-seated hatred and hostility, an irrational hatred and hostility, a bigotry born of stupidity that only flourishes in hierarchy disorder. So, on the eve of Ramadan, Muslim prisoners in Ohio are praying for basic fundamental accommodations. Well, when the guards aren't looking anyway. This is anarchist prisoner Abu Huraira Asim al-Quraish. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
What are the prospects for progressive change within the confines of the current political system? Is Britain's Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn a genuine leader of the people who can challenge the dominance of corporatism and imperialism? Did Bernie Sanders ever represent a threat to the Democratic Party establishment, or is he somehow reinforcing the elitist elements within its ranks? Could presidential candidate Jill Stein and the Green Party yet function as a conduit for the energies of thousands of Sanders supporters disenchanted by both of the mainline candidates in this November's presidential elections? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump secure their roles as their respective parties' presidential nominees, we look at the examples of three modern-day political leaders signaling promise for meaningful political change. We will hear from Commonwealth scholar and commentator Binoy Campmark about Jeremy Corbyn, the recently elected leader of Britain's Labour Party, and then we will hear fellow radio host and commentator Stephen Lendman talk about lessons learned from the U.S. presidential election campaign trail. On today's show, Jeremy Corbyn versus Bernie Sanders versus Jill Stein, prospects for real change? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 10th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Trump was the last GOP aspirant left standing after all others dropped out, an unlikely choice, a surprise winner prevailing despite party bosses opposing him. Democrat power brokers chose Clinton before primary caucus season began. The race was over before it started. Voters in November get to choose between a dirty business-as-usual billionaire racist demagogue and a recklessly dangerous neocon racketeer, war criminal, Wall Street tool, she-devil, fascist rule prevailing either way. Both candidates represent pure evil. That comes from the article, Democracy is Pure Fantasy, Trump versus Clinton in November, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 8th. Canada's foreign policy duplicity is also inherent in its support of another illegal government, that of the neo-Nazi-infested regime, offspring of the Western orchestrated coup that deposed the elected government of President Yanukovych. George Friedman, founder and CEO of Stratfor Intelligence, described the coup as, quote, the most overt coup in history, unquote. More recently, our duplicity was in full view when Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan stated publicly that Assad must go. This despite the fact that engineering regime change in a sovereign foreign country contradicts international law. Despite the fact that Canada's previous bombing campaign against Syria, now more of a support role, was a clear violation of international law. And despite the fact that the current sanctions levied against Syria are illegal as well. Clearly, Canada's humanitarian proclamations are hollow facades engineered to fool Canadians into thinking that we have a benevolent foreign policy, even as evidence demonstrates the opposite. That comes from the article Governing Through Lies and Deception by Mark Taliano, posted June 8th. According to a news report in the June 7th German economic news, Deutsche Wirtschaftsnachrichten, or DWN, headlined Merkel entmachtet BND USA kontrollieren Spionage in Deutschland, or Merkel ousts BND, US to control German espionage. A new law will soon be passed in the German parliament and be approved by Chancellor Angela Merkel, which will make Germany's version of the CIA, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, or BND, nothing more than a branch of the CIA, to such an extreme degree that even U.S. corporate espionage against German companies will become part of that German operation. The independent capacities of the BND will become emasculated, no longer operational under the new law. Quote, in practice, this means that the U.S. intelligence services, the NSA, will be allowed to continue to listen in on every company and every individual in Germany, unquote. This could be part of the West's buildup toward a global war. According to a report issued on June 6th in German Economic News, the German government is preparing to go to war against Russia and has, in draft form, a Bundeswehr report declaring Russia to be an enemy nation. That comes from the article, Germany's Foreign Intelligence Services, BND, to become branch of America's CIA, by Eric Zeus, posted June 8th. Some scientists believe that golden rice, which has been developed with funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, could help save the lives of around 670,000 children who die each year from vitamin A deficiency and another 350,000 who go blind. Greenpeace and other environmental groups say the claims being made by the pro-golden rice lobby are misleading and are oversimplifying the actual problems in combating vitamin A deficiency. Moreover, they argue that the golden rice program is diverting attention from other, more effective solutions. Many critics regard golden rice as an overhyped Trojan horse that biotechnology corporations and their allies hope will pave the way for the global approval of other, more profitable GMO crops. The Rockefeller Foundation might be regarded as a charitable entity, but its track record indicates it has been very much part of an agenda which facilitates commercial and geopolitical interests to the detriment of indigenous agriculture and local and national economies. That comes from the article, Pro-GMO Lobby, Genetically Engineered Golden Rice. Is this the solution for disease, poverty, and malnutrition? By Colin Todd Hunter, posted June 8th. Jeanette Shannon of Detroit was evicted from her home on June 3rd after a protracted fight against fraudulent real estate interests and the local courts which favor the predatory lenders and the banks. There is a proliferation of similar scenarios across the city stemming from the real estate and banking collapse of 2007-2008, leaving tens of thousands of vacant homes, many of which have been turned over to the unscrupulous developers and the notorious Detroit Land Bank Authority, the DLBA. A number of these so-called real estate developers exploit the situation when they are given preference in purchasing the properties through the Wayne County auction and those conducted by the DLBA. The homes are often sold on land contracts because, despite the ruling class propaganda that Detroit is being revitalized with property values increasing as well as rents, the banks wrote less than 500 mortgages during the entire year of 2015. After purchasing homes on land contracts from these companies, the residents soon discover that there are property tax and other liens on their homes. That comes from the article, Housing Struggle Continues in Detroit, Defying Landlords and Bankers, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 8th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In September of 2015, Great Britain's Labour Party elected anti-war campaigner and democratic socialist Jeremy Corbyn to the party leadership. Mr. Corbyn had campaigned on a number of positions that set him apart from predecessor Tony Blair, infamous for allying himself with George W. Bush at the time of the Iraq War. To get a better idea of who Mr. Corbyn is and how the British establishment might react to his leadership of the official opposition in the British Parliament, I brought in Dr. Binoy Kantmark. Dr. Kantmark was a Commonwealth scholar at Selwyn College in Cambridge. He lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne and is a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. The following interview was recorded back in September, within days of Corbyn's promotion. I'm joined once again by Binoy Kantmark, and I'm... Today we're going to discuss a little bit about the recent victory by Jeremy Corbyn as the new leader of Britain's Labour Party. So I know you've written extensively on the subject, so I just wanted to, first of all, you know, get your sense. Were you surprised by this victory in any way?
Well, I think many people were surprised by this particular victory for the simple reason that Jeremy Corbyn was considered the rank outsider for quite a considerable period of time. Virtually every other contender had some connection with the Tony Blair legacy, which is very important. The so-called New Labour grouping, if you like, Yvette Cooper, for example, Burnham and so forth. And this particular grouping never expected that someone like Jeremy Corbyn would actually come out, you know, with the numbers. You know, but as it turns out, someone associated roughly with, or very much so with the left faction of the party ended up storming in and taking over the shambles that was left by the previous election, of course, when the Tories did far better than was predicted.
Who is Jeremy Corbyn? Could you tell us a bit about his background?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has been in the background of, shall we say, Labour administration for many years. He had associations, in fact, with the Greater London Council. He had associations, in fact, you know, with Ken Livingstone, Red Ken, as he will be known to some people. And for many years, London was defined by Red Ken's presence. And Corbyn was in the background. Corbyn was associated with some of the policies connected with that and made a presence by virtue of that. But he was never really a frontline presence in terms of a climber in that associative sense. So what was interesting was to see him become, as it were, so prominent so quickly, which was, I think, a sign, more broadly speaking, of the lack of satisfaction within the party itself.
Mm. Now, he holds a number of positions that I'm not used to seeing among leaders of these the major what we call developed countries. It's hard to imagine a leader of a major party in Canada holding some of these positions. I'm wondering if there is a specific position that he's taken that seems to have the establishment on edge and is maybe behind the kind of ramping up of the propaganda campaign against him that seems to be already in evidence.
Yes, I think there are a few points to draw out from that question. The first thing is, what is setting people on edge, certainly the establishment on edge? Well, first and foremost, he has taken a very clear stance against austerity, which is the standard dogma that has been ingested wholeheartedly by certainly the European political establishment, the European financial establishment. And he's openly said that this is not the way to go. That's the first thing. So the first thing is the anti-austerity measure. But the second thing that's really riled individuals, and it's evident by the recent controversial responses that were made. One was by an anonymous general within the security establishment who claimed that if Corbyn was to come to power, if he was to be elected, and if he was to trim back the armed forces, there would be a coup, a potential coup, which is an astonishing thing, given the fact that supposedly in Britain these sorts of things don't happen. So even that particular statement was regarded with, you know, even within conservative ranks, it was regarded with a considerable distaste and worry. So that's just to give you an example about the effect Jeremy Corbyn's presence has. Firstly, you know, anti-austerity. Secondly, trimming back the military. And, of course, the third aspect, which is a corollary of the second, and that is to say he has decided to, should he become leader, to renegotiate, if not withdraw, from the EU. That's maybe a possibility, not sure yet. But the more significant thing is not even the European Union. It's the fact that Britain could renegotiate under Corbyn its position in NATO. And that has really sent, you know, put a cat amongst the pigeons. The very fact that Britain, one of the key members of NATO, one of the, you know, fellow conquistadores with the United States in Middle East adventurism and a range of other failed ventures, this particular suggestion has been quite astonishing. Not to mention the issue, and just links back to the security issue as well, that Corbyn has said that he would like to abandon and you know, the Trident program. In other words, initiate that great curse, as it were, and fear of Britain's security establishment, which is unilateral nuclear disarmament. And that's something that has really worried individuals connected with that.
That sounds absolutely remarkable to me. Because, I mean, I'm just so used to the idea of we saw with Blair and Bush, you know, shoulder to shoulder going into Iraq. And, I mean, they've been such a dynamic duo, so to speak. I'm wondering, I mean, is there an analog to Corbyn on this side of the Atlantic that –
I just don't see that. And for example, when it comes to even in the Canadian context, when we talk about Canadian politics, each of the individuals connected with the political debates show, I don't want to say a consensus, but essentially an agreement about Canada's role in, for example, security arrangements and intelligence gathering and a range of other things. You've got the most extreme variant of that, of course, in Stephen Harper, but then you also have even an individual like Justin Trudeau, for example, is hardly going to rock the boat enormously. There is an understanding at the core of it about Canada's role in North American, shall we say, affairs, and also the North American association, say, with NATO and a range of things. And considering the rest of the continent, if you like, when you can, you know, someone like Bernie Sanders perhaps might be regarded as closer, as an approximate value. But even Sanders doesn't come anywhere close to Corbyn. You just cannot imagine Sanders saying the sorts of things that Corbyn has been saying of late. You cannot imagine the United States abiding by its
nuclear disarmament.
Yes, it's just virtually impossible to envisage, even though admittedly the UK example is, even though it would be almost inconceivable to imagine Britain without its nuclear weapons, the thing to still envisage here is that Britain has a little more leeway potentially to make the difference on this. In the United States, it would have to lead to a fundamental revision of its security doctrine for it to, of course, disarm in that way.
Hmm. Well, then how united is, like, how does the general public of responding to Corbyn's victory in the Labour leadership?
This is a very interesting point, and this is something that's very, it's hard to say on a certain level. One thing is for sure, there is a considerable number of people, and this is evidenced by the fact that the British Labour Party had a huge enrollment, an explosion, if you like, in membership that took place when Corbyn was campaigning for the Labour leadership. And in fact, these were the numbers that got him up. These were the numbers that ended up getting him up in the Labour stakes, a total underestimation on the part of his opponents by individuals like Yvette Cooper and so forth, who just did not envisage him having this support. The very fact that he has this groundswell of support suggests that he is actually far more popular than is perhaps suggested. If he plays his cards well, he may even garner some conservative supporters in due course. Certainly, regarding the Liberal Democrats, many of them will be very impressed because Liberal Democrat voters were very disappointed about what happened with the so-called, the conservative, the Tory-Liberal alliance that took place, of course, previously with Cameron. And this particular Clegg-Cameron alliance was essentially, the sheep-wolf sort of association where the Liberals ended up, or the Liberal Democrats ended up being consumed by Tory policy. So Corbyn has an enormous scope here to create an impression in the way that his, previous members and associates have not been able to do.
So Houston, here in Canada, and I'm sure the United States, the idea of having somebody that far to the left being electable, the common wisdom is that you have to move to the center because you're going to alienate too many people. It seems inconceivable that somebody with Corbyn's credentials could actually become prime minister. What do you think? Is he electable?
Well, I think the way you frame your question enables me to answer it from a different way, or a different side, rather. And that is to say, and this reminded me, given the announcement recently, of course, that the infamous Australian dark force, the dark eminence of public relations, Lynton Crosby, was and is working with the Stephen Harper campaign. And that is what conservatives have been doing recently and of recent times. The argument is, well, do you want to be softer in your reactionary approach? Do you want to be more generous with refugees and asylum seekers? Do you want to be, more circumspect about who you bomb? But the reality of it is that Crosby's suggestion to Harper has been go full throttle for the extreme measure. In other words, let's move further to the right in order to win the center. So the paradox is, let us be more extreme in order to actually win government. And that seems to be the strategy that David Cameron adopted in the UK, and certainly the strategy that Stephen Harper is doing in the hope that this will end up pushing him across the line. So why not do it from the other side? Why not push oneself to the left in order to be more appealing? So rather than making the mistake of moving to the centre, why doesn't the left do in this case what the right are doing, which is to accentuate their tendencies? Rather than being more extremist to the right, let us be more extreme to the left. And this seems to be the Corbyn attitude, not that he's sitting there scrawling away and saying, I want to be more leftist to be appealing. He's simply doing what he's always done. I mean, the thing that's most interesting about Corbyn is that he's essentially sticking to a principles that, and even conservative commentators have admitted this, is that he's one of the few individuals in politics who's never wavered. He's actually very consistent. He's made it very clear he's a Republican. He's made it very clear that he's into unilateral disarmament. He's made it very clear that he is an individual who, yes, he is a patriot in a traditional sort of sense, but he's not a warmonger. He's not going to be going out and unduly deploying the UK forces in the name of foreign expeditions without value. I mean, he's made that clear. So from the start, he's actually made his position clear, which is it may frighten some people, but it's a very attractive position for members of the electorate who finally can see someone who they can vote for and who won't, as Margaret Thatcher said, go wobbly, as it were.
Well, it raises an interesting question because I'm so used to thinking of politics as being about the art of the possible and that compromise is at the heart of politics. So I'm wondering, is it possible that Mr. Corbyn can be co-opted in some way?
That's always a possibility. And of course, let's not adopt the heavenly pose here and suggest that he can't move about in his positioning, and he's going to, of course, have to make certain compromises. He's not going to go out and abolish Her Majesty's presence, for example.
Eliminate the monarchy.
Yes, because he himself, in fact, is on record now as suggesting that too many Brits seem to have it, have a certain affection or an interest in Elizabeth II. So there's not going to be a suggestion that he's going to go out and abolish it. But when it comes to certain positions, and as long as he maintains that particular stance, he could be a very powerful force, a very potent force. The question is, of course, whether the spin doctor element get to him. And so far, they haven't gotten to him, which is very interesting. And this is what's frightening. He's not following the PR class, the caste of the PR. The Linton Crosbys of the world. There's no Linton Crosby equivalent. He is his own man, which is an astonishing thing in recent politics, because you just don't see that in political operations these days. There's no Alastair Campbell around the corner. There's no, Crosby around the corner. There's no individual equivalent dark Iago giving advice, as it were. And you just don't tend to see that with Corbyn. And may that last. I hope that lasts. It may well change, and I can't, of course, predict the future on that. It may well be that when it comes to the crunch, when it comes to the election campaign, it's rather easy to forget at the moment that the person who's running Britain is not Corbyn, it is actually Cameron. The news that's coming out constantly is about what Corbyn's up to. But the reality is that he is not, of course, the Prime Minister of Britain, and he has to deal with people within his own ranks. And that may be the first challenge, actually. The big challenge is to try to scotch the Blairite dissenters, of which there are many, and there's no question about that.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask how united is the Labour Party behind him? I mean, could some sort of internal civil war doom his chances?
And that will be probably the thing that will do his chances, because at the end of this particular transformation, the question, of course, is how durable that particular, a Corbyn ascendancy is. Many of the individuals in his party who initially said, and this is very typical, first they did not think that he would be elected. Then they saw him get elected. Then they started changing their position and saying, well, having said I will not be part of a Corbyn ministry, they proceeded to say, well, I'll be open for that. But the very people who ended up starting to join the ministry started showing signs of dissent very early on. So, for example, the whole fracas about whether he sang the national anthem or not, of course, at the commemoration of the Battle of Britain, the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. And, of course, he did not sing. He wasn't exactly beating his chest and going hell for leather about the national anthem. And so, of course, some individuals took it as a chance to attack him and say that this was a distinctly unpatriotic gesture. And, of course, what was saddening within Labour Party ranks was that some of those were from the Labour front bench, and they made it explicitly clear, firstly, that they would support the expansion of strikes on Syria, which Corbyn opposes, and, of course, secondly, opposed and would oppose any compromise on Trident, or the disbandment of Trident, the nuclear deterrent that Britain has. And so these are the sorts of things that he has to contend with within his own ranks. Mm.
So I guess finally, I just wanted to ask a question about the establishment and the strategies, the tools they have at their disposal to deal with this anti-establishment labor leader. You mentioned the anonymous general who talked about a coup, evoking 1973 Chile. What do you anticipate the establishment will use against Corbyn to defeat his aspirations?
Well, an example of what to expect in terms of trying to deal with Corbyn is the and it happened actually very recently, some days ago, when Corbyn made the remark about what would happen in the event of a nuclear strike. And he actually openly said, and this is something that really sent shivers down the security establishment, And he said that he could never humanly envisage himself as possibly pressing the trigger. He could never press the button to launch nuclear weapons. It is a remarkable thing to say, as a potential leader of Britain, that you will not press the trigger under any circumstances. You will not press the button that would lead to a further intensification of a Holocaust, a nuclear Holocaust. A remarkable thing to say, and that is an example about how people will either scuttle his chances or enhance them. It's obvious that he is going to be elected on his word and not in spite of his word. So the question is whether that word holds true and whether it will prevail amidst the party apparatchiks and his enemies, of which there are no doubt many. And so the question then is whether this Corbyn experiment, if you like, from a range of things, be it security, be it in an economy where he's anti-austerity, so-called Corbynomics and a range of things about quantitative easing and these unpopular measures that are simply not done these days, it remains to be seen whether this will hold. I certainly have a lot of confidence that he has some energy in him to prevail, but we have to, of course, see how that ends up unfolding.
Okay. Well, Binoy Kamp, Mark, I've appreciated this conversation, and I'm looking forward to maybe having another interview with you at some point, but it's a very enlightening conversation. Thank you for that analysis.
Always a pleasure being with you, Michael.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Hillary Clinton is now the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president, less than 2 days after her victories in the California, New Jersey, South Dakota, and New Mexico primaries. President Barack Obama formally endorsed Clinton for president. Bernie Sanders told his supporters following the June 7th primaries that he intended to soldier on right until the Democratic convention in July. While Sanders has, at the time of this program is being assembled, has not formally conceded to his Democratic rival, he has signaled that he will not be running as an independent, much to the chagrin of many of his supporters, and may consider a role in a Clinton administration, possibly even as vice president. Now that the race is shaping up to be a Clinton versus Trump contest, I thought it would be a good idea to bring in prominent commentator Stephen Lendman to assess the prospects for democracy in America. Stephen Lendman is, of course, the host of the Progressive Radio NewsHour on the Progressive Radio Network and is the editor and contributor to a new book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. His blog site is sjlendman.blogspot.com, and he's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website and a frequent guest on this program. So, Stephen Lendman, thank you once again for joining us on the Global Research NewsHour.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's a joy to be on with you. It would be wonderful one day to have a discussion about all the wonderful things going on in the world. And unfortunately, the state of the world is not that way.
Okay, so we've got basically what seems like you've got the candidates that have effectively come together. I think at the outset, back maybe a year ago, people were thinking that we're not taking Donald Trump seriously and we're expecting that it would be Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush or somebody else, but not Donald Trump. But I don't know, when you look at Hillary's on the Democratic side, was there ever any real doubt in your mind that Hillary would be the chosen one?
Oh, not the slightest. I wrote in a couple of articles saying that she was chosen last year before the primary caucus season began, Michael. The real surprise was Trump emerging victorious for the GOP nomination. I mean, it really is very unusual that a candidate party bosses oppose, and they certainly opposed him, and I think there's still a lot of rumbling in the party, that he would emerge despite that. It shows, I think a lot of people are very upset about what's going on and under the delusion of thinking that he would make a difference if he became president. You know, he speaks differently and he's He says things that other candidates don't say. He sounds anti-establishment, but who ever heard of a billionaire who was anti-establishment? Does anybody ever think in those terms? Just the fact that he speaks differently doesn't mean that he would act differently. You just take a look at some of the things he says about individual issues, and the only thing I'm pleased about him, and who knows what he would do if he became president, was he's much more moderate, at least in his rhetoric about Putin and Russia, certainly than any other Republican candidate in Clinton. Now, whether he would act moderate if he became president is another issue entirely. Obama was the supreme peace candidate in 2007-2008, Michael, and look what he's done over the last 7.5 years.
That's true. I mean, I think it's pretty much, I mean, I might cynically say it's almost part of the resume of any politician that you're going to break your promise at some point or another. And so, I mean, it seems like folly. Like Obama, I think both Obama and Clinton in 2008 were talking about ripping up NAFTA and that sort of thing. And, of course, that didn't happen either. So it seems to me that it would be folly to expect that Donald Trump would keep some of any of his promises, even some of the more ludicrous ones like building a wall with Mexico.
I don't see any possibility of that happening. I don't know why he ever came up with something as nonsensical as that.
But do you think his followers expect him to break the word? Is it just that they like his style, or do they actually believe he's going to keep these promises?
Well, I think he appeals to the people who don't like the idea of undocumented immigrants whose skin color is different from their own, namely white, coming into America. I mean, they don't care about Canadians crossing the border and coming in, but they care about Mexicans or Africans or maybe Asians coming into America. So that kind of comment appeals to something like that. But you can build all the walls in the world, and you're not going to keep people from doing what they want to do. I mean, people are drowning at sea by the thousands, and they're still coming from the war zone, Syria and Afghanistan, Libya, wherever, and trying to make it to the European continent, and they'll keep doing it, and so a lot of them will be killed, a lot of them will make it. So, yeah, I mean, you can't stop people from trying to get away from a desperate situation on the possibility that things could be better for them, even risking their lives to do it. And Mexicans risk their lives to get to America, and it's been a good while since I've written about this, but Mexicans on their own crossing on land in the summertime through the desert, there are bodies strewn across the desert of Mexicans who did not make it.
And this business about registering Muslims and keeping Muslims at bay, I mean, is that just election year blarney, or do you think he actually might mean it?
Well, America has been at war with Islam for many, many years before George W. Bush, but it certainly accelerated after 9/11. And, you know, communism is gone as America's number one enemy, so you need something replacing it. And Islam, or you could call it radical Islam, I mean, most Islam is peaceful, just like most elements of Judaism and Christianity. And if you look at the dogma of all three religions, I mean, they're virtually the same. But you've got radical elements in all religions, and certainly not just those three. You get radical Buddhists and radical people from all sorts of religions. But again, the majority are people who don't want violence, who want peace, who simply want to live normal lives. But America needs enemies, so it created the enemy of Islam to give it an excuse to wage wars against Afghanistan and the Middle East countries and so on and so forth. So that's public enemy number one. And Trump is simply following along the same principles of Bush and Obama, and they're going a little bit extreme, saying he wants to keep Muslims out. Well, you know, Bush and Obama put them in prison, and Trump is saying he wants to keep them out. Well, I would bet better for them if they'd be kept out than to come in and be put in prison. I don't know how active that is right now, but it was very active post 9/11 with witch hunts against Muslims, and I wrote about so many individuals that were targeted unjustly and imprisoned for crimes they never committed. How much of that's going on right now, I don't know.
Well, I guess having enemies, I mean, it's not only good for the U.S. empire, but it's good for business, and Trump is ostensibly a big businessman, so you've got your...
Absolutely, and certainly wars are very good for business. If wars weren't profitable, there'd be no wars, Michael. They are so profitable, not just for the defense contractors, but all of the other companies that profit from the technology companies, the food companies, all sorts of companies profit from wars. And it's the reason America, throughout its entire history, has been at war every year, either internally or abroad or both, from before the beginning of the Republic in July 1776, before that, and every year thereafter. So even under the best of America's leaders, America has been a warrior state, and the condition it's in right now with the super weapons that exist, I mean, we're looking at the possibility of ending life on Earth if something, I don't think anybody wants to do this intentionally, but people make mistakes, and with the kind of super weapons that exist, anything could happen. It's really terrifying.
And it seems to me, when you look at these two candidates, Hillary versus Trump, if I could locate maybe one significant difference, or maybe it isn't so significant, but Trump, being a billionaire, is not as beholden to Wall Street and the neocons as Hillary appears to be. I mean, she's kind of bought and paid for by Wall Street, so she's I don't see any effort to resist that agenda. So I don't know. Is there anything to this this idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend? I mean, if you see the Wall Street imperialism, at least with Trump, and this could be why it seems as if there's a you're seeing so many of these neocons like Robert Kagan and others wanting to back Hillary as opposed to Trump, because I guess Trump is too much of a wild card.
That's very true. I don't think Trump, if he was elected, would differ very much from the system that's ongoing now. I think the power brokers would cut him a little bit of slack, give him a little bit of wiggle room. You know, that's okay. You know, like you take a commission on a sale, but, you know, the big money goes to the producer of the product, the deliverer of the service. So I think he'd get a little bit of wiggle room, but not a great deal. I think the endless wars would continue. I think the support for big business in Wall Street would continue. The police state laws would stay in place, and heaven knows what else he might institute. And I always say, forget the rhetoric of the politicians. Watch only what they're doing. So literally, you have to ignore everything that Bush ever said or Obama ever said or continues to say, and just look at their policies. What do they support? What laws do they sign into? And what legislation do they sign into laws? This tells you what they really are. When it comes to Sanders, you know, a rhetorical populist. But if you look at his record in the House and Senate, he votes with other Democrats 98% of the time. So what does that tell you?
You just mentioned Sanders. I'm going to just play a little bit of audio from after his meeting with Obama. So this just took place over the yesterday, I believe it was. So here's what he said to his supporters.
I am going to do everything in my power, and I will work as hard as I can to make sure that Donald Trump does not become president of the United States. I spoke briefly to Secretary Clinton on Tuesday night, and I congratulated her on her very strong campaign. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump and to create a government which represents all of us and not just the 1%. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I don't know if you managed to hear all of that, but...
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
So,
I quoted some of that in an article I put out today. If that doesn't sound like a concession and subservience to Hillary Clinton and the likelihood that Obama will be offered a position in her administration, probably a high-level one, maybe as vice president, and I would imagine whatever he's offered, he will accept.
Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, do you think there's anything to this idea of being able to exert influence within the administration, maybe tame things down a little bit? His comments about the fighting the forces of Wall Street and whatever, do you...
I would say the chances are zero.
Yeah, I'm inclined
to agree.
There's
no chance in the world. I mean, Sanders' record, again, in the House and Senate, is he basically goes along with most of the policies. The one that particularly gnawed at me was Obamacare. When I spoke to one of the people in one of his people in his office at the time when he voted for Obamacare. But the story on that was he was the only member of Congress and in the Senate, of course, to introduce a universal health care bill, the only one, and his rhetoric all along until the vote came along was supporting universal health care. And then he was pushed, he was pressured to go along with Obamacare, which is nothing but a health rationing scheme, enriching the big health care providers, the insurers and the drug companies and the hospital chains. And his vote, he didn't just support it, his vote was the difference between it being enacted or it being defeated. Literally, Michael, his vote was the deciding vote, and he went the wrong way, showing that he supported big business and he didn't care about giving proper health care, let alone universal health care, to ordinary people. And Obamacare really is an abomination.
Now, there was an article, I'm sure you're familiar with it, in Black Agenda report by managing editor Bruce Dixon. And he referred to Mr. Sanders as the sheepdog in the Democratic Party race. He says that going back decades, you've always had what they call sheepdog candidates. You know, there's Jesse Jackson in 1984 and 88, and Jerry Brown in 1992, Al Sharpton in 2000, 2004. In 2008, it was Dennis Kucinich. What he means by a sheepdog candidate is that you give left activists and voters a reason to believe that there's a place of influence within the Democratic Party. And when the eventual Democratic nominee is decided by early summer, so it's too late to try to organize an independent race through an independent candidate. Would you go along with that idea, that description of Bernie Sanders and why he was allowed to run and may perhaps even encouraged to run over the course of this race?
Well, I think the party needed somebody to run against Hillary Clinton, and Sanders certainly was eager and willing to do that. It wouldn't be. Clinton was anointed to be the Democrat nominee. And Michael, I always refer to the party as the Democrat Party, not the Democratic Party, because there's nothing democratic about it. So I go out of my way to use the Democrat word instead of Democratic. But it wouldn't be much of a campaign if Clinton had no opponent. So Sanders was willing and went along with it, played the game. I'm certain he knew from the outset he had no chance of being the nominee, whether he realized fully that Clinton was anointed as of last year. They both declared, I believe, on the same date last year, April 15th, 2015, the income tax day of all days. Why they picked that day, I don't know, long time ago. And Sanders, again, the rhetoric all along has been populist and so on and so forth. He's never really taken Clinton to task on the most important things you need to criticize her for. Her absolutely subservience to Wall Street, her support for the imperial wars, every one of them, from Afghanistan, the U.S. Senator, when Afghan war was launched, and of course the Syrian war and the Libyan war, and deposing governments in Honduras and Paraguay, and all the other horrors that she's been associated with. He's never taken her to task in no uncertain words about that. If you wanted to be an honest candidate, then you ought to be able to present her case honestly. But he's held back. He's held back because he knew that the ending of the process would be she'd get the nomination, and then he would have to look like he has to support her, which he will. And instead of saying nasty things about her, he'll say supportive words about her, going after Trump as the bad guy and building Clinton up as the good one. But there's saying he'll support her because he doesn't want to support the 1%. Well, what the heck does Clinton support? Clinton is part of the 1%, every bit as much as Trump is.
There is at least one other party running, and that's the Green Party and Jill Stein. What are your thoughts about her and the Green Party? Is it a lost cause? Is it worth supporting? What do you see in terms of being an instrument of some sort of democratic change?
I think Jill Stein is the real thing, but independent parties in America don't have a chance to go anywhere. The last one that came close to getting any kind of popular support was Ross Perot running against George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton in 1992. He got about 20% of the vote, and you got to go back a ways to see other independent candidates getting any kind of support. I think Teddy Roosevelt once ran in the Bull Moose Party. I'm going to check my facts on that, over a century ago. But an independent has never won in America, and especially today. I mean, the system is entirely rigged. You got a duopoly system, a one-party state with two wings, literally, and they take turns deciding who will run the Congress, who will run the administration, and that's the way the dirty game is played. But there really isn't much of a difference between the two parties on the major issues, Michael. They differ on some things. You know, one might go for stem cell research, another might be against it. But when it comes to war and peace and corporate empowerment and police state laws cracking down on people who don't believe in the system, they're absolutely 100% in lockstep. And Sanders, I believe, supports this ugly system, even though his rhetoric suggests otherwise.
Well, I mean, whatever you might think about Sanders himself, there is this movement of individuals behind him who I tend to think are for the most part sincere and authentic in their desire to and they are saying, they're not, a lot of them, if not the majority, they're not going to back Hillary Clinton. So what would you be inclined, what do you think will become of them? Are they just going to kind of evaporate? Are they going to possibly throw their support behind Jill Stein, or where do you think things will go from this point?
Well,
for the supporters,
of course, Jill Stein has no chance of winning. I mean, she'd be lucky to get 500,000 votes, and if she got 1 million, that would really be exceptional. She's a physician, and in one of my articles writing about her, I said something like she wanted to use her healing skills to heal the country. And I think she'd be a marvelous president, except for one thing. If she ever became president and tried to institute the policies she believes in, she'd have a JFK ending. They'd kill her. They'd get rid of her. So, you know, this is the way the system is. There's no possibility of changing this. I think the idea of changing the U.S. system at the ballot box is an exercise in futility. The only possibility of change is for people to decide on their own that they're not going to take it anymore and have a nonviolent revolution, which would almost change France in 1968, where literally the country was shut down for a number of weeks, especially in May 1968, and the de Gaulle government was on the ropes, literally on the ropes. It could have fallen, and the energy waned. It wasn't sustained, and because of that, the whole thing collapsed. You see this stuff going on in France right now, and probably the same ending will happen now. But if people conducted a campaign like this and stayed out in the streets and kept protesting honestly, and I believe nonviolently, and they simply refused to quit until they got the justice they deserved, then something good could happen. People could never get exactly what they wanted, but you could change this ugly system. If we could just end these imperial wars, Michael, and save the world from the possibility of a nuclear holocaust, that alone would be a major achievement.
Well, you mentioned things like, you know, people sort of taking to the streets and you know, demanding change. And like, it seems to me that's what Occupy Wall Street attempted to do. And
yeah.
What was the upshot of that?
Again, the energy wanes. Of course, whenever a activism like this sprouts up, it's attacked. It's attacked in different ways. It's attacked federally, attacked statewise, citywise, and we see what happens. You know, city police just using violence against these people. City after city, Zuccotti Park, if I remember the name of the park exactly, New York cops just beating up on these activists. And finally, you know, you take so much of this and the energy wanes. It was amazing how this thing just got so energetic in such a short period of time, spreading across the country like an uncontrollable wildfire. But yet after a number of months, the energy waned and the whole thing has just collapsed. I'd like to see it reinvigorated against and be more than just anti-Wall Street. I mean, anti-Wall Street, anti-war, anti-big business, any of the kind of things that are causing so much harm. America is being third-worldized. It's a country that's resembling Guatemala. It's a police state. It's just a deplorable situation. America was far from beautiful when I was young growing up in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. It was just a different country then. It's flawed and blemished as it was back then. And I was in the Army, but thankfully I was in the Army during a time of peace, never sent overseas to a war zone, never feared for my life. And service was mandatory in those days, so you had to serve in some capacity unless you were physically unable, 4F as they called it back then. But today it's completely different, and we've got a situation where endless wars rage in multiple theaters. We've got nuclear weapons, we've got other super weapons, and we've got neocons in Washington, bipartisan neocons in the Republican and Democrat Party that by a mistake or design could literally launch something that could cross a Rubicon of no return, and heaven help us all if that happens. I mean, I don't know that it will happen, but the threat is there, and nothing is being done to defuse it.
Just wanted to inspect that point that you're making about the way the electoral system is simply not a route to justice, because I plan to run this interview in conjunction with another interview I did some time ago about Jeremy Corbyn, who is the newly elected leader of the Labour Party. And I don't know, he seems to be what you'd say the real deal. He seems to have the right stance on a lot of issues. I think he even got attacked by Tony Blair not very recently over his stance on Syria. Is there not a prospect of, maybe Bernie Sanders was not quite the right example, but in the UK, could someone like Jeremy Corbyn possibly be someone worth rallying behind, or is that a lost cause?
I don't think rallying behind an individual is going to do anything. I think you need a movement. You need a movement with good leadership. Corbyn could be a good leader. Martin Luther King certainly was a wonderful leader for civil rights. I don't see anybody in America that has the leadership stature. I mean, Muhammad Ali would be a wonderful leader if we could resurrect him and restore his youth to get out there and be anti-war and pro-civil rights and so on. Somebody with the prominence to influence a lot of people, but of course we don't have them. I'm not aware of anybody in America that has the prominence or the stature or the interest in getting out and leading a movement for the kind of justice and anti-war and pro-populism that we need. And Sanders certainly is not that individual. He's literally caved throughout his political career, saying one thing and end up doing something entirely different. I've never trusted him for going back a good many years. I simply don't trust him. I don't trust him now. And I expect him to become part of the Clinton administration, which would be the ultimate sellout to his supporters.
Mm. So you've got a kind of a situation where, I mean, the structure of power is when you have these establishment figures, they're effectively representing the corporate entities, and what you want in terms of people power is something more along the lines of the labor movement or the union movement, so that you've got that sort of dance between the forces of the corporations and the forces of labor, and that way. You may not be able to elect one of your own, but you can keep them in check through the forces of popular mobilization. Does that make sense to you?
Oh yeah, it certainly does. I wish I could live long enough to see something happen that could really give me the idea that change was possible. I'm getting up in years. I don't think I have enough years left to see the kind of change I dream of. I mean, I'd be delighted just to see the kind of country I grew up in return, which we certainly don't have now. I never heard of the term neocon back when I was going to school, college and graduate school in the 1950s. When things were so much different than they were today, when a Republican meant an Eisenhower Republican, and today it means a Trump or a George W. Bush or a Jeb Bush. Earlier you mentioned, and talking about the unlikelihood of Trump becoming the nominee, I really expected Jeb Bush. You mentioned Jeb Bush earlier. I really expected him to be the Republican nominee, and it's really astonishing how his campaign just collapsed. But that really amazes me.
Okay. Well, Stephen, I have enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure we'll have you back at some point for more commentary, perhaps as the election day comes closer. That is, if you don't decide to leave the country by then. But, Stephen,
stick away, Michael. Stick away.
True enough. Stephen Lendman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, we've been joined by Stephen Lendman. He is the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, and you can find his blog site at sjlendman.blogspot.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.